Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Like I said, we will not be intimidated. We're going to play football games. Hatred, violence will not intimidate us.
Coach, is that why you need the state troopers, Coach?
Look, I don't need no John Brown state troopers. You can tell whoever threw this brick through my window, they can come visit me anytime. I'll be at home.
I think it's time you stopped antagonizing everybody and learned a little humility.
Humility, huh?
You know, if you could just keep your mouth shut, Herman, if you didn't brag so much, we might.
See. So you blaming me for what happened last night?
No, I am talking about setting a good example for our boys and for the community.
I don't scratch my head unless it itches, and I don't dance unless I hear some music. I will not be intimidated. That's just the way it is.
Today, the city of Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., is mourning and remembering a Titan.
You smiling? Why are you smiling?
Football's fun.
You think football is fun?
Yes, no.
No?
Sir, but it was fun.
Not anymore, though, is it?
That's Denzel Washington in the 2000 film Remember the Titans. He's playing T.C. Williams' head football coach, Herman Boone. The real Coach Boone died at home yesterday from lung cancer. He was 84.
Boone's coaching tenure at T.C. Williams came as the city of Alexandria's public schools were integrating during the Vietnam War. He was the Titans' first African-American head coach, and he led the school to that now famous state championship title in 1971. Former T.C. Williams student-athlete MacArthur Myers says Coach Boone's influence transcended sports.
Myself and a lot of other African-Americans didn't have a vision of what to do after high school. We knew that the war was going on, so they were drafting us left and right. College was not on the radar because some of us weren't trained to think beyond high school. So Coach Boone was set with me and said, think beyond the war. He said, if that's not the only option you have, you can go to college. And I wound up going to American University.
According to Myers, Coach Boone was his homeroom teacher and also the school's driving instructor, wrestling coach, and black student union advisor.
So he was a stabilizer. He was always available, flexible, but he was a no-nonsense. He would allow you to be yourself, but he would always look at you with the expectation you're supposed to know what to do was right.
And when asked if Denzel Washington's depiction of Coach Boone was accurate, MacArthur Myers said it was on point.
It is on point because Coach Boone acted as an advisor, and the young person that wrote the script also went to T.C. Williams. So Denzel, he got it. He got it right.
A few years ago, Coach Boone told an audience that the film wasn't just about football. He said it was showing the world how one can overcome their fear of diversity.
Under my leadership, I'm proud to say that this football team, even under extreme conditions, became one of the best football teams in America. And even though they did not like one another at first because they were different colors and different races, they learned early in their lives to accept the soul of an individual rather than reject any member of that team based on the color of their skin.
Former T.C. Williams High School football coach Herman Boone died Wednesday at age 84.
Little brother, I heard y'all ain't hitting in New York.
Word.
I heard y'all ain't hitting in L.A.
Word, word.
I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
New documents released from the University of North Carolina system
reveal the timeline and some internal communications about a deal reached with North Carolina Sons of Confederate Veterans over the controversial Silent Sam statue. The deal transferred ownership of Silent Sam to the Confederate group, along with $2.5 million, to preserve and display the statue. UNC Board of Governors members also revealed an additional payment to the Sons of Confederate Veterans. That came out yesterday in an opinion piece published in the News and Observer about why the board went through with the deal. Will Michaels has been reporting on this and more. He is WUNC's Daily News reporter, and he is with us now. Welcome back, Will.
Hey, Frank.
Tell us about these documents. What's in them?
Well, a few things. I will say in general, we did answer a few questions that I had about this settlement, but not all of the questions. And this collection of documents actually, I think, brings up some new questions. To give you sort of a broad idea of what happened yesterday, the UNC system released, by my count, 337 pages worth of documents, but only about 40 of them were information that I was not privy to before. So it indicates to me that there's a lot ahead here.
A lot more. Well, one of the biggest revelations from the new documents, the stuff that we hadn't seen already, is an additional payment to the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this payment is in the amount of $74,999. And if that sounds a little odd, it is. You think, why not just go ahead and round that up to $75,000? It appears to be because there is a state law that says any payment that involves a state entity that is $75,000 or more has to go through a review of the Attorney General's office. So it appears that the UNC Board of Governors, in giving this additional money to the Sons of Confederate Veterans, was able to circumvent that review with the Attorney General's office. Now, this money turned out to be sort of a contingency plan. They put together this separate settlement with the idea that if they did not come to a larger settlement, this $2.5 million settlement, that this $75,000 would be in exchange for the Confederate group not putting any Confederate banners or not holding any events on public university campuses. Now, because the deal did go through, the Sons of Confederate Veterans still gets that money, but they are allowed to have events on public university campuses.
Wait a minute. Forgive me. I don't quite understand. If it's a contingency, and I know you didn't write this deal, so maybe there's some evidence in the documents itself that tells you if it's a contingency, say, if we don't make a deal on this, the whole thing, here's 75 grand. Please stay off our campus with your signs and your protests. But we did make a deal. So why do we go through and pay them the money? And why can they come on campus and make the protest?
That, I think, would be one of the questions that is raised by these new documents, of
That's
course.
That's not new documents, right.
Right. So, no, it simply says that if a larger deal is made, we will allow you to have events on campus. If this deal is not made, we won't allow you to have events on campus. Now, because the deal was made, like I said, they are still allowed to have events, but they are not allowed to bring flags or banners onto public university campuses for the next 5 years.
All right, what do we learn about the timeline of this settlement?
A little bit more. I mean, one of the questions I didn't have was how long has the UNC Board of Governors and the Sons of Confederate Veterans really been talking about this? In this collection of documents, there is an email from one of the leaders of the Sons of Confederate Veterans to UNC Board of Governors member Bob Rucho, dated February of 2019, that says he would like to put together a meeting with Dr. Rucho to talk about the Confederate monument. There is no other correspondence regarding the monument in this collection of documents anyway between February of 2019 and November 19th of 2019 when the UNC system goes to the Attorney General's office and asks for validation to use outside counsel to put together a potential settlement with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. So there is a big gap there between February and November of correspondence. There simply isn't, in these documents anyway, correspondence regarding Silent Sam in those 7 months.
Well, something went on somewhere because very quickly, very shortly thereafter, a lawsuit was filed and settled within hours, right?
Right. And this is leading up. That's 8 days, if you remember, as you say, before November 27th, when a lawsuit from the Sons of Confederate Veterans was filed at 11:10 a.m. and a settlement was approved by a judge at 11:17 a.m. And then a few hours later, the UNC system came out with a press release outlining this $2.5 million settlement for the preservation of Silent Sam.
All right, so lots of questions there still unanswered by these documents that have been just released, so we'll stay tuned. Meanwhile, there was an apology letter from the commander of the Sons of Confederate Veterans that was included in these documents. Apparently, an apology over the leaked memo from the Confederate organization. Tell us about the apology.
Sure. And just to go back for a second, this leaked memo was put out, first to Durham attorney Greg Doucette just a few days after the settlement was announced. And in it, the leader of the Sons of Confederate Veterans talks about how he intends to use the money. I mean, this is a key piece of really this whole conversation, because it was this memo that sort of set off all of these questions about not just the $2.5 million going to a neo-Confederate group, but what it might be used for and whether it might be used for propaganda or their agenda, because in this letter he does lay out his intentions, which includes building a headquarters for the Sons of Confederate Veterans in North Carolina. They did release with these documents yesterday a letter that was dated December 14th, so just 3 days ago, from the same leader of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, Kevin Stone, saying, essentially apologizing for what he called puffing and bragging to his fellow members about this settlement. He said it was not in the spirit of the deal and that they will stick to what the settlement says, which says for the preservation, transportation, security associated with the monuments and a facility for it, but does not include it. It does say in the settlement agreement that they cannot use this money for propaganda.
All right. And these documents also, the Board of Governors members came out strongly. We learn that there was an attempt to block this. There would have been a resistance to the legal settlement that was ultimately agreed to. Legal action that may have taken place. Board of Governors objected to that, and we found out more about that. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this goes back to Friday, last Friday, when the UNC Board of Governors was holding its December meeting by teleconference. The same day, a civil rights law firm filed legal action in pursuit of blocking this settlement on behalf of seven students and faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. The UNC Board of Governors, the chair, Randy Ramsey, actually released a statement yesterday condemning in pretty strong language that lawsuit, saying that this, or it's not a lawsuit, but it's legal action, saying that that legal action would essentially, this group was seeking to put the monument back up on campus. Now, if that sounds a little confusing, the position that the UNC Board of Governors is taking essentially here is that this settlement or the monument goes back up on campus. So they're saying that by this civil rights group, by putting by taking legal action, essentially is paving the way for the monument to go back up. Now, I reached out to that group. They haven't responded to what Chair Randy Ramsey said, but they also spell out in their legal action the harm that they believe the statue has done to the university community over the years.
Yeah, so it could be also perceived as a threat. You file this, you try to block our settlement, and that statue goes right back up on campus, which is, of course, the last thing that you would want if you want to block the settlement. And also part of the argument is, if you'd have taken them to court, they probably would have lost, that is, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, because they may not have had standing. Why didn't you challenge them? Is that part of the argument now and part of what critics are still saying?
Exactly. I mean, that's part of what this legal action says right there in black and white. And, the Board of Governors seems to be falling back on this 2015 state law that widely protects public monuments. And in their talks about this settlement have said that because we are giving this over to a private entity, it's now private property and not covered by this 2015 state law. And that, this sort of ensures that it's not going to go back up on campus, which is what we wanted all along. That's their position.
We will stay tuned. Will Michaels, WNC Daily News reporter and producer. Thanks so much, Will.
Thanks, Frank.
We that got through, we are more submissive. We submitted to our teachers. And we let them bend us and mold us. And the more we look like we accepted the bending and the molding, they applauded us. They patted us on the back. They gave us a star on the forehead. They gave us a passing grade. So you become the first Negro to do this, or the first Negro to do that, or the first Negro.
34. That's how old Richard Hatcher was when he was elected mayor of Gary, Indiana in 1967.
This has been one of the most significant campaigns in the history of our city. true. It marks the end of years of corrupt machine control of the city's government. This is indeed a great day for the city of Gary.
He was the city's first black mayor, and his win signified changes in U.S. politics following the civil rights movement. Mayor Richard Hatcher is being heralded as the last of the first. He died Friday at 86. Earlier today, we spoke with Ravi Perry, whose books include Black Mayors, White Majorities, The Balancing Act of Racial Politics. I asked him, what was it about the Hatcher campaign that was striking to people?
But Richard Hatcher was able to convince many of the whites there in 67 that while, yes, he was someone who was going to ensure that all people were, in fact, equitably represented, he emphasized that that included the black folks from the side of town on which he was raised. It's a unique story in that we saw black politicians who were actually running as black people in majority white areas. And so that's what makes Hatcher's death really so sad, because it really is also, to some extent, the death of an era in which the first elected black mayors of major cities in this country realized that they could run and seek white crossover votes successfully.
Richard Hatcher grew up one of 13 kids. His father molded railroad car wheels. His mother was a factory worker. He understood manufacturing life, and yet he was unable to stem the end of the manufacturing era in Gary, right? As steel begins to leave that city and other kinds of manufacturing leaves other cities. What did it mean for this wave of politicians, mayors, black candidates who had just come to power and then saw the economic basis of their cities suffer?
Yes. Well, what we call in political science is this term of the hollow prize, that after the cities have already been depleted of its resources, after it's lost the wealth that it once had in terms of a tax base that was perhaps white and middle class, then you see African-Americans be able to get the power of the actual elected seats. But they win these seats without the resources that their predecessors had, and yet we're still having to fight against overly high expectations that some of their own black community expected of them. Although I should say rightly so, because the first time anyone becomes the first of your own to get elected, people who represent your communities are going to feel as though they finally, for the first time, have a chance to perhaps get their interests represented, because everyone who does not look like them beforehand was unsuccessful in doing that in their view.
He had once organized the National Black Political Convention in Gary. That was in 72. He served as chairman of Jesse Jackson's Democratic presidential campaign in 84. All these years later, after we had the election of Barack Obama in 2008, what is Hatcher's legacy?
We should think of Richard Hatcher in the vein of those vanguard black elected leaders in this country that saw to it that they should use the power of their position to advocate for the least among us, for the most vulnerable and for the marginalized. And that ushered in a whole new wave of black elected officials, from Tom Bradley in L.A. to Norm Rice in Seattle, to Andrew Young and Maynard Jackson in Atlanta, or whether it be the president of the United States. You can run as a black person in a majority white jurisdiction and not run away from your blackness and still win.
Ravi Perry, chair of the political science department at Howard University, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
Arr! Arr! Huh! There's the old and strange.
That is called the duck's foot pistol, but it's basically, it's a volley gun. Yeah, so it would all fire at once.
The new and controversial.
An assault rifle has a definable term.
And some 7,000 firearms of all kinds in between. The Cody Firearms Museum was created in the 1970s, mostly with gun enthusiasts in mind.
This looks at the post-World War II period.
But after a brand new $12 million renovation, says curator Ashley Lubinsky, it can now tell a broader and necessary story.
Firearms have been integral to understanding, really, history, culture, technology, and society for centuries. And so having a firearms museum is really just a way that you can use those artifacts as a vehicle to talk about other topics.
That includes guns as weapons of war, for sports and hunting, as innovative technology.
Henry Ford visited Winchester right before he built his Highland Park factory in Detroit. And he took what he learned at Winchester and applied that to the assembly line that he's become famous for. But you don't necessarily hear, you know, that firearms part of the story, and that's gotten lost, definitely.
Housed in the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, the firearms collection is one of five museums of art and history, including the story of Buffalo Bill Cody himself, the legendary soldier and hunter turned showman, who in 1896 helped establish this small town in northwest Wyoming, a deeply conservative state where guns have always been part of life. The Buffalo Bill Center asks visitors to check visible firearms.
I don't think there's a guy in this community or a family in this community that doesn't have a gun in their home.
That includes former Senator Alan Simpson, who grew up and now 88, still lives in Cody.
There would be no history in America without the gun. I mean, you can gasp and choke and fall over on your head if you want to with that statement I just made. But, I mean, without a gun, the pioneers would have had nothing but an axe and fighting off the elements and indigenous people. All of that is real. All of it. You can't rewrite history.
But I could imagine people saying, okay, that's all true, but a museum to celebrate guns?
We tell the history. We're not in a celebratory thing down here where we have a big sign, come on in and cherish guns with us. That's bull. This is the history of America, which is guns.
I was afraid that it was going to glorify firearms.
Artist April Jones, who lives and works nearby, is a much newer resident of Cody, one who came with different politics and from a very different place, the San Francisco Bay Area.
A lot of my friends back there would be quite offended that there was a museum about guns.
But Jones is impressed with the museum's approach.
I think that's a nice balance, you know, to understand that, okay, you've got your sports shooters on the one hand that are competing in Olympic events for target shooting and that kind of stuff, but then you've got people who are living in turmoil and destruction because of firearms too. And I think that's more the conversation that our country should be having, is it's a tool, in what cases can it be used properly, and how can we stop it from being used improperly?
There's no denying the fascination many have with guns. Visitors from all over the world, here from the Netherlands, come to try them out at the nearby Cody Firearms Experience. General Manager Paul Brock knows it's the movies that often drive people his way.
When people say, I don't know what to shoot, we'll say, okay, well, let's do, what do you want, Johnny Depp, John Wayne, or John Wick?
We got to try all three. A 1790s Indian trade musket. An 1873 Colt single-action revolver. And a modern AR-15.
The oldest firearm you did the best shooting with, so nice
job. An old-fashioned guy.
Yeah, there you go.
The only shooting at the Cody Firearms Museum is with simulators to teach safety and illustrate different gun mechanisms. Here they aim for something else, such as getting definitions right.
It says these terms are used frequently but rarely in the correct ways.
Correct.
As in just what is meant by an assault weapon.
If you are trying to create legislation for or against firearms, or whether you're trying to regulate these things, you have to be precise in the wording of that legislation. So it's important to have the historical foundation of what those words mean in order to actually make sure you're talking about the right thing that you're trying to do in politics.
There's also this, a large mural originally made for the cover of Time magazine last year, showing several hundred people across the Great American Gun Divide. And not every museum visitor loves it.
We've had a couple of people on all sides say, you know, this is really divisive. You know, why would you put this up?
And what do you say to them?
It's a very divisive debate. And this actually represents equal footing. And it's okay to love it. It's okay to hate it. We want to encourage people to think really long and hard about firearms, to make their own conclusions about firearms. And this is an opportunity in the museum to feel something.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at the Cody, Wyoming Firearms Museum.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
I don't think it's about Monavie.
We'll send home a troubling letter December 6th.
The first one said we were frustrated that we were getting reports of racial harassment.
Then yesterday, another letter went out.
We had more incidents reported to us throughout this week.
In one incident in an online chat room, a student called the African-American male she was talking with the N-word.
Nigger!
It doesn't surprise me based on kind of what's the climate of the country right now.
Lalaine Shepard says her son Brighton was the target of racist graffiti written inside a boy's bathroom at Monta Vista in 2016.
It stays with you. You know, because they are hurtful.
Her son graduated last year. She credits school officials with trying to improve things, but
there's always going to be hate, right? There's always going to be hateful words. But I think it's really a matter of how we address it as adults.
Monta Vista is not identifying the student involved in the incident, but they say there are already programs from inside and outside the district to reduce racial animosity and increase understanding. Officials vow to keep trying and say there will be repercussions.
We'll follow the ed code and there will be serious consequences.
The principal sums up his letter by saying they will not shrink away from racism at Monta Vista High. Instead, they will confront it and talk about it openly in hopes of making more progress this time.
Black babies cost less.
The Centers for Disease Control and other health organizations have long championed the virtues of breastfeeding. But back in 1946, an effort began by the St. Louis-based company Pet Milk to market formula to a growing Black American market. And they did this in what is being called a brazen act of exploitation, using four identical baby girls known as the Fultz Quads to market their products. And while Pet Milk made millions, the girls ended up in poverty. For University of Hawaii Associate Professor Andrea Freeman, the Fultz Quad story is part of a larger history of Black women discouraged from breastfeeding. She intertwines these stories in her new book, Skimmed: Breastfeeding, Race, and Injustice. And she joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Andrea, you begin this book with the birth of the Quads: Mary Louise, Mary Ann, Mary Alice, and Mary Catherine. Quads were rare back then. Natural quads are still very rare today. So, of course, they immediately became famous. And their exploitation began at birth with their doctor, Fred Klenner. Tell us more about some of the ways he did that.
Fred Klenner was kind of an unusual doctor. He had a theory about the healing powers of vitamin C. So right on the day of their birth, he injected them with vitamin C, and he did that every day for years afterwards. The next thing that he did was take away the privilege of naming them.
Yes, I mentioned their names, and their names are actually because of him.
Yeah, he decided that he was going to name them. And he gave them all the first name Mary, and then the names of his wife, daughter, aunt, and mother. He then decided to auction off the rights to a formula company to use for their promotional materials.
And let's talk about that. He began bidding for the rights to be the baby's corporate sponsor. Pet Milk was the winner. What did they agree to provide for the babies and their parents?
The primary thing they agreed to was milk. So pet milk was their major source of nutrition and diet. They said that they would give them a nurse, which was a nurse chosen by Dr. Klenner so that he could retain control over the quads and to keep using them for his experiments. They bought a house for the family, which in those days, of course, would have been a really big deal. But they bought the house from Dr. Klenner's father-in-law on land that was very hilly and barren and impossible to really farm. So every part of the deal benefited Dr. Klenner and didn't really do too much for the sisters and the family.
Yeah. As you write, the Fultz quads were born at a time when companies were just starting to market to Black Americans. Talk a little bit about how the girls were used to actually promote pet milk.
They were featured in a lot of magazine advertisements. They did performances, so they did music and dancing. They went on television. They went in parades. They did society events.
Yeah. This story, the quad story, is important because it brings us to some of the larger issues that you explore in your book. As you write, Black women have the lowest breastfeeding rates in the United States. And one of the contributing factors is that for decades, many Black American women were forced because of economic circumstances to work outside of the home. And this ties into the quads because they were really selling to moms, hey, here is this way that you can nourish your child. And basically, the undercurrent was that we know because you won't be breastfeeding. This is the alternative.
And that assumption that Black women won't breastfeed is still with us, even through changing economic times. I mean, they haven't changed that much. We still have a lot of disparity in employment and income and wealth that makes it necessary for many Black women to work.
And then you write in your book about some of the barriers that Black women face when they enter medical establishments, hospitals, learning how to breastfeed, whether they're given the tools to breastfeed. What did you learn there?
There is an assumption by healthcare professionals that Black women simply will not breastfeed. So many times they're not given the training and the support that white women get when they're in the hospital. They're immediately given free formula and encouraged to just bottle feed with formula instead of trying. And for most people, it's difficult to breastfeed at first. It's not something natural, even though I think it's often presented that way. It's something that takes work and takes learning how to do it. And if those resources are not provided, then it simply becomes impossible.
One of the hardest parts to get through in your book was the chapter on how enslaved Black women were forced to wet nurse white babies, which of course meant that they had to forego breastfeeding their own. And it sort of sounds counterintuitive, but not breastfeeding, you say, was seen as a way for Black women to reclaim their bodies. Can you explain more for us on that idea?
Yes, the idea that during slavery, Black women had no choice about nursing white children and breastfeeding in general was controlled outside of their own bodies, sometimes can put people into a position where they feel like to be liberated and to be free and to be self-determinative, it is a better choice not to breastfeed.
Hmm. The Fultz quads, I mean, they were beautiful babies. They went on to work with pet milk throughout their childhood. What happened to them?
They always had a difficult life. Even when they were born and they were celebrities, they were isolated because of Dr. Klenner, even from their own siblings. So they had six siblings, but Dr. Klenner did not want them to play with them, to spend time with them. Then when they turned six, Dr. Klenner went to a judge and asked the judge to appoint the nurse that he had given them as their guardian. The judge said yes, and the sisters moved away from their family, and from that time on, barely saw them. They had a difficult time in school because there were so many demands put on them by pet milk to suddenly make appearances, jump out of school, jump back in. And by the time they got to high school and college, they were very behind, so they weren't successful. They went to college for 2 years, and then they were asked to leave. And at that point, their guardians moved them up to outside New York because it was their dream to perform. They had a small nightclub act, but it never took off. So they worked in factories and nursing homes.
And the most tragic part of this is all four were diagnosed with breast cancer when they were in their 40s. Three of them died by the age of 55. Catherine was the only one who lived into her 70s, and she blamed Dr. Klinner's vitamin treatments for she and her sister's cancers. Do you agree with that?
It's really hard to tell. It might have also had something to do with this diet of the formula through their not just infancy, but also kind of toddlerhood, which is very unhealthy. So we have the experiments, we have this diet heavy in sugar and fat, and we have the trauma that they experienced. So I really don't know why they all received these diagnoses. I do know that it's highly unusual for multiples to all get breast cancer, but I think we'll never know what the real medical cause was.
Yeah. You make this through line from slavery to then the quads and the marketing of formula to Black women, bringing us to the present day. Why did you want to write this book?
I think that a lot of people see breastfeeding as a choice. And because of the culture that we have around breastfeeding now, as reflective of good mothering and good parenting, people interpret not breastfeeding as bad mothering or bad parenting. For Black women, a lot of the time, there's no choice involved. It's just not a decision because there's so many structural and social factors that make it impossible. Yet this circumstance is socially interpreted as evidence of being a bad mother. And I think it's important for people to understand that this is a structural problem. This is not a personal choice issue.
Andrea Freeman's book is Skimmed: Breastfeeding, Race, and Injustice. Andrea, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tanya. It was great to talk to you.
Medical Apartheid: The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present.
Black and Hispanic Americans are especially vulnerable to Alzheimer's, but these groups are often underrepresented in scientific studies of the disease. NPR's John Hamilton says scientists are trying new ways to diversify their research.
Scientists often look for study volunteers at clinics or medical centers. But a team from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland is trying something different. On this Sunday morning, they've come to a fundraising walk organized by the local chapter of the Alzheimer's Association.
Well, good morning, everybody. How's everybody doing?
Before the walk begins, the crowd gets a pep talk from Representative Stephanie Howes. She's African-American. She also takes care of her mother, who has dementia.
Some days have been hard, right? Yeah, right. But we've been having a lot of great days, a lot of good memories.
A diverse crowd of about 4,000 people have shown up, and the ones who stop by the vendor tables are likely to meet Leah Cummings, one of two research associates from the medical school at Case Western.
So we're looking for families, minorities, and people with early onset. It's a genetic study.
Cummings explains that the goal is to find genes that contribute to memory loss, especially genes that might be different in African Americans and Hispanics.
And this gives you some more information about our study.
Okay.
It gives you all the details that you're going to need.
Okay.
And then feel free to take anything else that you... Okay.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Cummings says despite the big crowd, the study is a tough sell.
So far, no one has signed up, but we're hoping that we'll get a few names today.
The recruiting effort in Cleveland is part of a nationwide strategy funded by the National Institute on Aging. Jonathan Haynes, a professor at Case Western, says diversifying research studies is the best way to answer some outstanding questions about race, ethnicity, and Alzheimer's.
Historically, we have not been looking at a lot of the diverse populations, and so there's some evidence that it's different in different populations, but there's a lot that we still need to learn.
So Haynes and other researchers are asking minority communities for help.
We actually need to have thousands and thousands of individuals participate in these studies to really understand the genetics of Alzheimer's disease.
The university is trying to make it easy to participate. People who sign up can even ask to have a researcher visit their home to collect blood samples and health information. But Haynes says in minority communities, it's about more than convenience.
One of the concerns that we often deal with is an issue of trust.
Trust in doctors and medical institutions and the good intentions of researchers. That often requires building a relationship. And Haynes says talking to people at an Alzheimer's walk is one way to start.
In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, let's walk!
Today's walkers include many African Americans. One is Robert Smith, whose aunt has Alzheimer's.
I've been up since 2:30 this morning, and I ran over here to make sure I made the event.
Smith says he's no fan of doctor visits, but would consider signing up for an Alzheimer's study.
Yeah, absolutely. If it may help find a cure, I'm all for it.
Rosita Brantley has a grandfather who died with Alzheimer's, and Brantley works in the dementia unit of a retirement home. So I ask if she's interested in joining the genetic study at Case Western.
Well, yes, because I would want to know if it's genetic, you know, if it's in my genes, you know, will it be passed down? Yeah, I would do it if I was asked, yeah.
Case Western researchers were able to sign up 4 people for their study before the walk was over. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Hey, Scooby!
Scooby, Scooby-Doo, looking for you. Scooby, Scooby-Doo, where are you?
All right, so cops have long had dogs and also robots to help them do their jobs. Well, now they have a robot dog. Robotics company Boston Dynamics is loaning out its dog-like robot named Spot to police departments, beginning with the Massachusetts State Police. This is raising questions about the future of police robotics and what kind of oversight there should be. From member station WBUR, Allie Germanning has the story.
Spot is a robot that gets a reaction.
Oh, my goodness. It's kind of scary looking, actually.
It looks like one of those things, some aliens, you know?
Feels like it has a brain to me. And I feel like that's alive. I wouldn't go near that.
Those are people in Boston watching videos of Spot, opening doors and climbing over snowbanks. Spot kind of looks like a headless dog, a metal one. It has 4 legs, a long arm, and a 360-degree camera. Massachusetts State Police became the first law enforcement agency in the country to get access to Spot earlier this year with a 3-month loan. The loan was revealed in documents requested by the ACLU of Massachusetts. Why lend this brand new robot to police? Michael Perry is vice president of business development at Boston Dynamics.
We've tried to make the robot as customizable as possible so that our customers can do exploration and really totally understand what the value of a legged robot is in the real world.
Police have long used robots when dealing with potential bombs or hostage situations, places where they wouldn't want to send a human in. State police troopers were giddy about getting to use the more nimble Spot. Spot's police handlers gave specific feedback to Boston Dynamics. Spot did great walking over big dirt mounds, but not so great dealing with tall grass. In 2 real-life police calls, it checked out a suspicious briefcase and surveilled a barricaded suspect. Both Boston Dynamics and State Police are quick to say that Spot wasn't and won't be weaponized, but it's not unheard of.
It appears to be the first time police have ever used a robot bomb on U.S. soil.
As NBC News reported in 2016, Dallas police sent a bomb disposal robot armed with explosives to kill a sniper. That sniper had earlier killed 5 police officers. Boston Dynamics says a lease agreement won't allow clients to use Spot to physically harm or intimidate people. But that doesn't quell concerns from people like Cade Crockford, director of the Technology for Liberty program at the ACLU of Massachusetts.
The secrecy surrounding all of that is very concerning.
Crockford wants to see a policy from state police, or even a state law, about the use of robotics. And they want more openness about the program.
The technology that can be used in concert with a robotic system like this is almost limitless in terms of what kinds of surveillance and potentially even weaponization operations may be allowed.
Even some law enforcement officers see the need for more transparency about how police are using robots. Thor Eales is the executive director of the National Tactical Officers Association and a former SWAT commander. He gets that people want to know more about how robots are used. Law enforcement should balance any tactical secrecy with the public's right to know how their police departments are working.
These tools are used in critical incidents. The primary
purpose of it is to gather information to help in making decisions that can ultimately save lives.
He noted police still have to abide by the law. If you need a warrant to send a person into someone's home, you also need one to send a robot. But judging from the trooper's excitement over the robot dog, Spot will probably be on a few police departments' wish lists. For NPR News, I'm Allie Jarmanning in Boston.
New York. New York, New York.
New York City approved a plan this week to hire 500 new transit officers to patrol subways and buses in an effort to make them safer. But some riders are protesting the city's increased police presence at stations. Those were protesters in Brooklyn last month chanting, "How do you spell racist? NYPD." Riders are complaining about what they call over-policing of black and brown riders and a recent increase in fares. And New York isn't the only place where protests are taking place. Chile's massive protests started with rate hikes, and protesters brought Hong Kong to its knees by using transit stops to protest larger issues. Terry Nguyen is a reporter with Vox and has been writing about this. Terry, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
There's a long history here of racial profiling and targeting, and this feels like an extension of that history. An NYPD report released in August found almost 90% of the people arrested for fare evasion are black or Latino. What is the reason for that? How does race and class fuel these movements?
Yeah, so I did like read through MTA data, and it's striking to me because as just a casual user of the MTA, you've noticed people of all different sorts of demographics and different from different classes and from different boroughs using it. So what activists say about class is that with a rise in fares and like class and race are interconnected, you're already targeting vulnerable poorer people. And in New York, it's impossible to get anywhere without taking the MTA. And activists are concerned about the rise in fares because they feel that poor people already are not likely to live close to transit hubs, and this will affect how they get to their jobs, and not being able to afford transit will affect their livelihood, essentially.
Yeah, New York isn't the only place, though, that we're seeing these uprisings. There are other places. I'm thinking of Chile, for instance, which comes to mind. How is public transportation playing a role on these ongoing demonstrations around the world as part of what some are calling a global protest wave?
Yeah, so public transit systems have become either a space for protest or they're inadvertently affected by ongoing demonstrations worldwide. And I think with strikes and protests in France, various cities' transit networks, especially Paris, are struggling to operate. There's also tension, as you mentioned, in Santiago, Chile, and in Hong Kong, because residents see these systems as an extension of their local government, but they're also a public service. So in Chile, for example, whatever policies are passed, like a fare hike or an increased policing in New York, it's seen as a state's priority, but people are really disgruntled when it's not fully reflecting their will.
And talk more about that, you know, because it's symptomatic of a larger issue that people are feeling perhaps more policed, as you said, in New York in that case. But there are also other issues that rise up, really, and this is sort of the symbol of that.
Yeah. So I spoke to some political science experts who study like public space and protest, and they say that a change, even a fare hike of a few cents, can really strike a nerve. And it's a pressure cooker environment, right? Like these protests are not completely tied to the public transit system, but because transit affects so many people, it's really easy for people of different classes, of different demographics, to feel like they're being collectively impacted by something like a fare hike.
Yeah. What motivates cities to raise fares? I'm guessing it has to do with collecting more money for city services, but I'm just wondering some of the reasons why some cities say they're doing this, and also a crackdown on fare evasion, why that's such a priority for many, many places.
Yeah. So most public transit systems in American cities, it's important to know that they rely on fares to function. And the problem is most of our transit systems aren't profitable. In fact, it's very rare to see a profitable system. In New York, fares account for about 38%, I think, of the MTA's annual earnings. And so the idea of cracking down on fare evasion, at least from New York officials' point of view, is that they're going to lose less money compared to what they're currently losing. But A lot of citizens are confused as to why an agency and the New York MTA already has such a high budget deficit. They feel like it's unfair that they're spending more on law enforcement. But according to the city, how much they're spending will bring in more fares. So it will make up for what they're spending.
I'm also wondering, how do other cities incentivize people to pay the fare without using the police?
Yeah, so I've read up on some transit systems in other European cities. Most of them have adopted a proof of payment system as early as, I think, in the 1960s. So instead of having these turnstiles or these gates that make boarding slower, that require people to scan their card or swipe their card through, they have undercover operatives who will randomly check people's tickets. And I spoke to researchers from Australia. They say that having these undercover operatives keep commuters on their toes, which means they're more likely to pay for a ticket. And this isn't only in Europe. In San Francisco, for their bus system, they've also implemented something of that sort. And it makes transit systems much faster.
Terry Nguyen is a reporter for Vox's The Goods. Terry, thank you so much for this.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And some U.S. cities are taking another approach by decriminalizing transit fare evasion or getting rid of fares altogether. Your thoughts on the issue are welcome at hereandnow.org.
Curtis Flowers has been in prison for 22 years. Much of that time has been spent on death row. That was until Monday, after he was released on bail. His case has drawn national attention because of racial bias and prosecutorial misconduct. Flowers is a black man tried 6 times for a quadruple murder. The American Public Media podcast In the Dark has chronicled how a prosecutor repeatedly kept black residents off the jury in his trials. In the Dark host Madeline Barron is on the line now from Winona, Mississippi. Good morning, Madeline.
Good morning.
Can you just remind us about Curtis Flowers, his story, and how he ended up on death row?
So Curtis Flowers is from this small town, Winona, Mississippi. And after this quadruple murder in 96, he was arrested, sent to trial, convicted, appealed, won, tried again, and this case has gone on and on since then, 4 convictions and death sentences, 2 mistrials. But it's worth pointing out that every time the jury who convicted Curtis Flowers was either all white or mostly white, and when he won his appeals, it was always on the grounds of prosecutorial misconduct, and including all the way to the Supreme Court.
Okay, so now he's been granted bail. I guess my first question is him. How is he doing?
Well, you know, Curtis has always been described to us as someone who's happy-go-lucky, sunny disposition, and that's certainly what we saw at the jail yesterday afternoon, where he came out with his sisters on either side of him, and we actually have some tape of what he said.
I feel good right now. I'm happy I'm out to be spending time with family. Looking forward to Christmas.
And he just said, you know, I'm kind of overwhelmed here at the same time.
I mean, we have spoken about this case before. Your podcast has put so much attention on the alleged bias here. I mean, parts of the podcast were even played in the hearing yesterday. As you follow this so closely, did you see this day coming?
You know, it's hard to say. When you do an investigative story, you know, you find out a lot of new information, but you never know what the impact will be. And so it's hard to say. I mean, it's not common to get bail in capital cases, but this is not a normal case. We investigated extensively all the evidence in the case, and it did not hold up to scrutiny.
Remind me about the prosecutor who has been such a huge focus in all of this.
So he's an elected district attorney. His name is Doug Evans, and he's the same person who's brought this case to trial all 6 times. And interestingly enough, he was absent from the courtroom yesterday. He sent a junior prosecutor, and the judge was not pleased. He said, look, I expected to see Doug Evans here, and he's clearly not happy that he sent someone else in his stead.
And so Curtis Flowers, I mean, looking ahead now, he says he's looking forward to Christmas. He's out on bail. I mean, he's been retried before, right? Could that happen again? Could this not be the end for him?
Yes, it could. And, you know, this is a thing we found out. There's this kind of legal Groundhog Day in our criminal justice system, where if you're tried and convicted and you win your appeal, there's actually no limit to the number of times you can be tried. So we're just waiting to see what the prosecutor will do in this case.
All right, that is Madeline Barron. She's host of the American Public Media podcast, In the Dark. Thanks so much for all of your reporting on Curtis Flowers' story and for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
It's not simply that they identify Garvey as dangerous. The FBI basically identifies black people as dangerous across the board, seriously. And their logic there, actually, there's some logic to that. And their logic is black people in America are treated like garbage. And because they're treated like garbage, they, you know, their loyalties are suspect. Black people in America are treated like garbage.
A proposed petrochemical plant in Louisiana is a complete and utter disaster. So there's a proposed petrochemical plant in St. James Parish, Louisiana, and it's raised legitimate concerns about possibly disrupting a slave burial site and also creating additional pollution in an area that's been dubbed Cancer Alley. So what's essentially happening is they are supposed to have excavators work with them to figure out whether or not there are burial sites around the property where they're planning on constructing this petrochemical plant. And they did find some interesting information. A proposed sprawling petrochemical complex in southern Louisiana will be built on land holding historic cemetery sites that experts believe were likely slave burial grounds. Although initial cultural surveys conducted by the company in 2018 had indicated there were not historically significant sites on the land Formosa, that's the Taiwanese company building this, plans to build on. The company was later alerted to maps from the late 19th century submitted to the state's Division of Archaeology by an independent researcher that indicated two cemeteries tied to old plantations on the land. Now, Formosa has found one of these sites, the Buena Vista Cemetery, still intact. There's a lot of worry. There are activists in the area that were already concerned about this plant and the pollution that it's going to lead to, but now they're concerned about the historical significance of that site and whether this company is going to go ahead and build, on that site anyway. Now, the $9.4 billion plastics complex named the Sunshine Project, which is weird name, is being proposed by a Taiwanese petrochemical company, Formosa Plastics, and would consist of 14 separate plants across 2,300 acres of land in St. James Parish. If approved, it would be allowed to roughly double the amount of toxic emissions in the parish annually. And I just want to note, of course, the majority of individuals living in that area are African American.
Duh.
So, there's a number of problems here. The gravesite, obviously, as we just discussed. But the thing that drives me the craziest is constantly putting it in African American areas. Oh, it's called Cancer Alley. Let's give it to black folks. And then pretend that we're fair to African Americans and there's no racism left in this country. And then when you say things like Black Lives Matter, they say, what's the big deal? You're treated the same.
All lives matter.
All lives matter. No, no, no. All lives have not mattered equally in this country for a long, long time, for the entire history of this country. And now, you think it's over? It's not over. So whenever they're gonna put something that doubles the number of toxic chemicals in the air, they're like, let's put it in a black community. Let's put it so that black families suffer, so that black kids breathe that air. And then we'll then say, there's no racism. So, okay. Then they'll say, it's economic concerns. We had to do it because, we need the energy and we need to improve the economy. All right, great. Why don't we put it in Beverly Hills? Oh, no, 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 no. Why don't we put it in Manhattan? Why don't we put it on Wall Street? No, 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 no. Those are rich white folks who can't do that. Just put all that toxic stuff in every African-American neighborhood and then pretend there's no racism. It's disgusting what they do to minorities in this country. We have got to all unite to fight back against this monstrosity.
Absolutely. Again, not one of the big news stories. Got very little attention. It was written about by The Guardian.
60 miles away, they had the Tulsa riots years before I was born. But they never talked about them.
Never?
Slaughter. It was a slaughter. They never talked about it. The old folks never talked about it when I was in Oklahoma.
Wow.
I heard a rumor about it. I didn't know what to think.
Wow. What do you remember, like, what started it? What made all this come?
A black teenager was on the elevator carrying a big box, and trying to carry the box, he stepped back and bumped up against a white woman. End of story. Ride his own. People formed at the, you know, he was arrested. People formed at the jail. A few black people showed up. Somebody, you know, everybody had guns, including black people back in those days in Oklahoma. Somebody fired a shot, and that was it. Stampede was on. Call out the National Guard, which is all white, and they added to it. Shooting every black person they saw. Wasn't a riot, it was a war. Wasn't like these riots we had in the 1960s where people run around knocking out windows and grabbing stuff, like they did in California a few years ago. None of that. No. It was people killing people.
How many people died?
Some estimate said around 300, 400, and some estimates are much lower. Because black people didn't know how to stay out of the way and whatnot, but the thing about it, nobody really knows because it wasn't accurately reported, because it wasn't supposed to be happening, but, you know.
Do you think it's possible that 300 to 400 people could have been killed?
Sure. You know, killing a black person, you don't get no time for that. You don't even get called in court. You know, killing a black person is like killing a roach.
We have a new clue in a nearly century-old unsolved mystery. In 1921, a white mob burned down Tulsa, Oklahoma's African-American section after a black teen apparently stepped on the foot of a white teen in an elevator. More than 1,000 homes, churches, and businesses were destroyed, but no one has been able to say how many people were killed or where they were buried. A new discovery could change that, as NPR's Wade Goodwin reports from Tulsa.
On the northern bank of the Arkansas River, where the old Santa Fe Railroad Bridge crosses the water, a homeless campsite squats along the sandy riverbank.
See that railroad trestle right there? There have been stories over the years that bodies were dropped off of it into the Arkansas River. We don't think that happened. We think that they dropped them onto a sandbar that we know was there.
On the riverbank area known as the Canes, Scott Ellsworth stands on what may be sacred ground, or maybe not. Ellsworth is the author of Death in a Promised Land, perhaps the definitive account of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. Ellsworth says nobody knows how many died. Estimates run as high as 300. Afterward, the white authorities cordoned off the town and confined the surviving black residents at gunpoint. They were hiding a horrific sight. African-American mothers, fathers, children, grandparents lying in the streets, some draped over wooden fences that fronted the ashes of what had been their homes and businesses. Ellsworth believes some of the dead were loaded onto rail cars and dropped onto a large sandbar in the Arkansas riverbed.
The authorities didn't know how to get rid of these bodies. They were laid out there for a couple days. It's summertime in Tulsa. We think what happened is that they brought in a steam shovel and dug two trenches here and then brought the bodies up from the sandbar and buried them here and covered them up and didn't tell anyone about it.
For generations, white Tulsa and the state of Oklahoma repressed this history. Forget about putting it in school books. Just bringing up the subject of the massacre could bring threats. Tulsa City Councilwoman Vanessa Hal Harper grew up here. She says she inherited the fight for a memorial and to find the grave sites from the previous generation of Tulsa's black politicians.
This is not the first time that this issue has come up. When the first commission was initiated approximately 20 years ago, there was conversation, there was talk about doing something about these mass graves. But for whatever reason, I believe the powers that be decided, no, we don't want to do this now. And it just dissipated, it just stopped.
But over the last few months, an effort to find where the dead are buried has gathered new and significant momentum. Using ground-penetrating radar and other methods, researchers spent weeks searching several sites. They've identified at least two which show underground anomalies consistent with mass graves. The next step is to finish the scanning and then excavation. 23 years ago, I traveled to Tulsa to report on the efforts of its black community to memorialize the massacre. In 1996, the last of the survivors were still alive. George Monroe was playing with his friend next door when he first smelled the smoke and saw the white mob come over the horizon.
I never will forget some things that I saw, even though I was 5 years old.
Monroe's mother hid him and his sisters under the big bed.
The guys with the torches did come into the house. And after they came in and set the curtains on fire, they were leaving, and one stepped on my finger out on the edge of the bed. And I was just about to holler and scream when my older sister that was next to me put a hand over my mouth. Now, I remember this as if it was yesterday.
George Monroe and his family survived the massacre. He died in 2001. But in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the struggle to acknowledge what happened on June 1, 1921 is still very much alive. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Tulsa.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 21, 2019, so I have been told. Solstice, they say, shortest day of the year, starts heading back the other way. Days get a little bit longer. Compensatory call in, dial in if you have thoughts, suggestions, questions, gripes to share about the news reports or other elements related to white supremacy, racism. I was looking at, I was looking online just making sure. University of Michigan, Scott Ellsworth, he wrote the Death on the Promised Land on the Tulsa, what they call Tulsa Race Riot. I even want to pause right there because this program, Compensatory Call, is supposed to be about words. Remember back when they called Bill Cosby a terrorist? Did you hear the word terrorism in that report where they're talking about 300 corpses of black people? Did you hear the word terrorism? Number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Man, oh man, I am excited. We will be here tomorrow. Dr. Thomas A. Foster. Rethinking Rufus, sexual violations of enslaved black, or excuse me, blacks not in the title. That's one of my questions. The title is Rethinking Rufus, sexual violations of enslaved males, enslaved men, excuse me. The question is, why is it not sexual violations of enslaved black males or black men? Not that I use that word, because there are no enslaved white males being violated in this book. That subject has not come up at all. I'm almost at the conclusion. And unless he has a whole lot of reports of white men being raped and sodomized and such down as the book ends, I have not heard of one white person in this book. Not saying it never happened, but that's just not the subject. Wow. Again, I'll say you should put this book together with Dr. Curry's The Man Knot and Vincent Woodard, The Delectable Negro Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture. But we will be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Dr. Thomas A. Foster. If folks have any free time, you can check out some of his pictures and let me know if you think he's classified as white or not, Dr. Foster. Anywho, things to get to before we get to the callers. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. We are also on Cash App, the address cash.app/$thecows. Enormous gratitude to all the investors who have supported and kept the cows on air for nearly 11 years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you are not into all of the 21st century ways of financial transactions, you can drop me an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. Again, tremendous thanks to all of the Cal supporters. I hope the program has provided accurate information on white supremacy, racism, and suggestions on what racism, white supremacy is, what we can do to solve this problem immediately. You can also visit the wish list at Amazon.com. It is listed under Gus T. Renegade. Again, huge thanks to all the folks who've nabbed items for about 11 years now, as we have been on the air. Huge thanks. Oh, wow. What a long list. What a day. Let's see. Even where to figure out where to start at on my list of things. I'll start there. Reading is more important than watching television. I'm not really interested in talking about The Watchmen because I'm not going to view it. So I'm not interested in hearing an analysis of it, if anyone's seen it. I'm just mentioning it because Tulsa was at the conclusion there. And they said that in this series, The Watchmen, which is on HBO, is supposed to be about racism. It has a lot of black actors. I've already said if it's got a lot of black actors in it, I don't want to see it. But they recreate the terrorist attack in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I mentioned this before. We had people who called in and said that they watched Central Park 5, didn't watch that either, and said that they were traumatized. Like, you know, it made them ill. They felt nauseous even having to view it. And I am done with that. Had that with Precious and many other films. I'm not going to sit down and subject myself to content where I'm going to feel ill. And the point of this was what exactly? Was I being compensated to do this? Is this part of a project? Am I doing this to, you know, further my understanding of racism, white supremacy? If none of those goals is, if this is leisure activity, I'm good. I'd rather do something that's going to be replenishing, that's not just going to further traumatize me. I can just go watch snuff films of enforcement officers killing black people. But yeah, and particularly giving all the graphic details, black people, corpses hung on fences where they were trying to run for their lives. I want to see that recreated and then keep up with this on a weekly basis. I'm good. To the clips. Wowee. They talked about Silent Sam in North Carolina. The Sons of the Confederacy, suspected race soldiers, getting some sort of financial settlement to agree to not come on the campus, University of North Carolina, and to do other things, I guess, to aid the refinement of white supremacy racism, not drive the cost of practicing racism up astronomically to have these conflagrations. Sometimes someone might get killed or injured, have to have enforcement officials out, and can be costly. So to not do all this, we'll give you, they said, I think $75,000. And I immediately thought, has Al Sharpton ever gotten like $75,000 to not do a protest somewhere? Any of the folks affiliated with Black Lives Matter, did they give, you know, we've already seen this. We'll come to a compromise. We'll, you know, give you a cool $50,000. Just don't come out here. Stay on your side of the street. No protests, no flags. Just chill out. You know, here's $50,000. Did they do that? Like, I have never been compensated to not hang out and upset people with my wrangling and protest in life. That has never happened to me. So if that's been your experience, you've been paid off to not protest, please share. This was not in the audio clips, but I did think this was significant. I think we talked about Robert Kraft, the Patriots owner. He was arrested, some sort of prostitution sting earlier this year. At the beginning, it was almost a year ago. People were talking about that. They were even connecting it with Meek Mill. And then I saw he and Meek Mill were hanging out again today. And they were talking about so-called criminal justice reform. They had a bunch of black children, and they said that these were black children who had been violated in some way. I think it was parole, got in trouble and something where the system didn't do correct by them. And so they took them out, got them a shopping spree, took them to the game today, a whole lot of stuff. But they had all these children and then Robert Kraft hanging out there. Thought he was sexual. Anyway, they said, save that one. The report on the firearm museum system of racism, white supremacy. I'm not sure if there was a system of justice, if there would be a firearm museum. Maybe there would. Maybe there would. But really? And then the more I thought about it, I said, oh, wait a minute. We read the Wisdom of Psychopaths, Kevin Dutton. He went to the serial killer museum. People that were with us for the book club, where he talked about that, going there, and Jeffrey Dahmer, Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy, and they recreate some of the scene. Like, what kind of ghoulishness is the same thing? I gotta watch. That's my entertainment for the evening. We will watch what happened at Tulsa. Ah, they get to kill hundreds of black people. Yes. Then we'll go to the serial killer museum. Yes. Read all about Jeffrey Dahmer and how he ate them up, cooked them and ate them, raped some too. And then we'll go to the firearm museum, learn about the history. And the white man got obstinate, the curator there. Started cursing on the end. I was like, wow, isn't this on NPR? I thought they have a no profanity pod. They had to have their bleeps and everything ready for his potty mouth. Let's see. The Great Equalizer. Couldn't forget Dr. Welsing. That is what she called the firearm, the Great Equalizer. I'm sure she would. I suspect Dr. Welsing would have been at the firearm museum to study what is on display here. Check the ISIS papers if you have not read The Great Equalizer. Let's see. Skimmed reading, more important than watching television. I thought about not playing that, but then I said, oh, that's really important. We should go ahead and play that. And the reason I thought about not playing it is because Andrea Freeman, the white woman suspected racist who authored that book, Skimmed, about how the deliberate campaign to keep black mothers from breastfeeding their child, which is pretty universally, I don't know too many people who say, oh, breastfeeding, that's some nonsense. That's not healthy. I don't know too many people who have any sort of scientific background who say that's a bad thing. Most of the folks that I know that have some sort of expertise in that area, in fact, generally say, oh, man, it doesn't get any better. That is the best of the best right there. You're talking about nourishment for your child. Let's do some breastfeeding. And from my prenatal yoga teacher training, they gave us the information that it's recommended that for the first 5 years, you do breastfeeding exclusively, a minimum. Like if you want to be quote unquote lazy about it, 2 years minimum. That's the standard from the whites in the lab coats. And many of the non-white people that I know that have expertise in this area, doesn't get any better than breastfeeding. They do the exact opposite with black mothers. We'll make sure we encourage them not to do that. And even words, I told you, a lot of system of racism, white supremacy, a lot of time racists, masters of deceivers and wordsmiths, they will articulate and phrase things in such a manner that it may be subject to multiple interpretations. Now you can hear Pet Milk, maybe that's the name of the company, an acronym, whatever it is. You can also hear Pet Milk and think, oh, this is food for non-humans. Man not, woman not, child not. This is pet food. We do not think of niggers, even the babies, as humans, so we don't give them human milk, breast milk. We give them pet milk. Maybe I'm just, you know, radical, militant, confused nigger. Very possible. Medical apartheid. One of my favorites all time. Constructive value is how I generally rate my favorites. Top five, medical apartheid, Harriet A. Washington in the book club. I thought about that. I thought of Henrietta Lacks because it sounded so similar. I even got confused for a moment when they said she was in the hospital, had quadruplets, and the doctor immediately, oh my goodness, I've got an idea, and I've got these four new niggers. I know, I'll begin my injections. I was thinking Henrietta Lacks immediately, like that's what it is. Just an, and Dr. Cambon, he says, again, we don't have ignorant racists. You have scientific racists. That is a lot of what the system of white supremacy is about. Mr. Fuller talked about the plantation. That is a science lab. The slave ship, that is a science lab. The prison, that is a science lab, meaning this is an environment where I have people who are totally vulnerable. They've been completely subdued. We dominate them. We can do whatever we want. And they're captive. They can't go anywhere. We got them where we want, greater confinement. We got them where we want them. So we can observe what happens, the changes in behavior, make documentation. From birth, the attack beginning at birth. As soon as they were born, get my needle, whammo, get to the injections. Let's see. They said auction. After I do my injections, I do my experiment. I name the children after me. Like, I don't even give an opportunity for black mother, any other relatives. You have any idea what you want to name? No. Probably on crack or something. I'll name them after me and my family, my white family. And then we'll auction off the rights. Again, I got confused. I didn't know if they were talking about Edward Baptist. The half has never been told. Thought they said slavery was over. What are we doing auctioning off black children? And they said 1940s. I thought they had just went and fought. Hitler said, we're getting rid of all the racists. We're about democracy. That's what they said, 1940s. And they're auctioning off the rights to black babies. Dr. Welsing, again, throw away children. That's what you can expect. They are waiting. Racist goals. Man not, woman not, child not. Let's see. The word fair was used quite a bit in numerous segments. It wasn't even just one. It was all over. The segment where they talked about the pollution in Louisiana, Cancer Alley, they called it. There have been a number of, but that's not new. They've been calling it that for years. I think that'd be a metaphor, unless I'm mistaken, Cancer Alley. But they've been calling it that for years. This is our plan. We've been planning this methodically for years. Make sure if Katrina didn't drown them, we'll make sure we dump all kinds of toxins and pollutants on them. So if we didn't drown you in Katrina and all the rest of it, we'll make sure that you'll be gagging and full of asthma and everything else while you stay down here in the bayou. I started that segment with Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly. He was on the program. He's been a multiple time guest, but the first time I was back in 2009. And he said the comment about black people are treated like garbage. And we white people, we know black people are treated like garbage. So their loyalties are suspect. That's why we got to have a COINTELPRO program, because we know that these niggers, eventually they're going to get upset about all this. Henrietta Lacks and such, and might try to do something about all this. We spy on them, got our COINTELPRO. So we know, we keep tabs on them, know what they're doing. I thought that we treat them like garbage. We treat them like garbage. We know their loyalties are suspect. You can't be ignorant about racism, white supremacy. It can't be predictable that you're going to have all of the landfills and chemical dumps and major entities that pollute. Can't be ignorant about racism if guarantee, oh yeah, where do the niggers live? That's where we're going to put the new landfill. Oh yeah, trash and trash all together. Curtis Flowers, I'll probably wait and talk about that when we get to Mumia Abu-Jamal. Words are so important. There were so many metaphors that were invoked this week. One thing I will say, Curtis Flowers, they said that he was in kind of a legal Groundhog Day. I saw that there movie. I don't remember Curtis Flowers being in the movie. And I have no idea how that relates to Curtis Flowers from the movie, unless I'm mistaken. You had a white man who would just get up and it would be the same day over and over and over until he figured out whatever he needed to do to stop that. That's not Curtis Flowers' situation by any means. To be on death row in Mississippi and be convicted six different times, that is not Groundhog Day at all. I don't remember anything about that with Bill Murray. Maybe I saw the wrong movie. Maybe they got something. That's what I mean about those metaphors. Let's see, which other ones did we have? the segment on the first black mayors, they said that some of these black people winning the position of mayor, it proved that you don't have to run away from your blackness. I have no idea. I couldn't even give you a guess at what that means. You don't have to run away from your blackness to win elections. President Obama, who has a white parent, just faced historic levels of death threats. I've not heard a report in 3 years that President Trump is facing the same level of hostility. He was impeached. And I've not heard any report saying that he's faced the same level of violent hostility that President Obama faced. And he had a white parent. It's not even logical, some of the things that get said. And they only talked about winning mayor. I don't remember Andrew Gillum doing well down in Florida, not running away from his blackness and talking about racism. I don't remember that at all. Maybe I missed it. I forgot the victim of white supremacy in Georgia who lost because I didn't think she was going to win in the first place. I didn't even dignify that with trying to guess. I knew that a white person was going to win in Georgia, but I don't remember that working out well, not running away from your blackness. I would challenge anybody. Kamala Harris, is she there? Cory Booker, is he looking like a favorite for 2020? Cory Booker does not have a white parent. Sorry, messed up before. But I'm continuing. What other goofy words did we hear in the segment? Pressure cooker. They were talking about New York. Fare evaders. Folks out there trying to not pay to ride the metro, the subway. Metro Transit authorities got to do all they can. We got these unruly niggers running amok in New York City. Got to have increased enforcement officials to make sure that people are not hopping the turnstiles and all the rest of it. Incidentally, in Seattle, we have proof of payment system. They don't have turnstiles when you go to catch the train or any of that. They have proof of payment system. Not a whole lot of niggers that are on the trains or the buses anyway. But they said that it's like a pressure cooker. I used my pressure cooker today. That was why that stood out. I got fresh or uncooked chickpeas. You have to soak them overnight, or it's recommended at least you soak them overnight, or you can boil them. Or if you have a pressure cooker, you can just pop them in there 3 hours, boop, ready to roll. Or you can do it on 3 hours high. You can do it on 6 hours for low. But that's a pressure cooker. I don't know what he's talking about. If you're talking about being in a major metropolitan area, because they talked about a lot of other areas, Chile, China, lots of other areas. If you are a victim of white supremacy and whites continue to make basic human necessities more difficult for you to access, like water, transportation, unpoisoned food, they make all of these things difficult and then have the audacity to, oh man, it's like a pressure cooker. What are you talking about? And that's delectable Negro too. I think you put food in a pressure cooker. Words are super important. Let's all make an effort to try to use the most accurate words that we can to describe the problem that we are talking about, white supremacy, racism. Similarly, master deceivers, one of their major tactics, they will use incorrect words. They will use a lot of metaphors to make comparisons, often to insist that two separate entities are identical. And frequently that is not the case at all. That is racism. That is master deception. Gus T. Renegade, other victims of white supremacy, we've been exposed to this misconduct for centuries. And many of us, we are still learning, which is fine. But it often does mean sometimes you don't have logic, data to articulate your views. Sometimes we'll substitute, use an analogy, metaphor of some sort. Frequently, that just produces a lot more confusion. If we could work to be precise, exact, specific with what we want to say, that would be appreciated. If you need more time to gather your terms, that is always allowed and appreciated. I do that myself. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. Folks who are planning to be with us for our retreat, be looking be on the lookout. Gus T will be dialing folks, go over details, make sure everyone is all ready for next weekend. Hopefully white people will cooperate, won't have any difficulties, and we can all travel safely. Yoga, vegan food, get back safely for 2020. Anything else? Oh, man. Last thing. 10-year anniversary, almost 11 years now. 10-year anniversary of the cows. I've said for, I think from the very beginning, the inception of the cows, I am not a nice person. Nothing has changed in 11 years about that. I'm still a misanthrope, which means someone who does not really enjoy being around people. I am still a curmudgeon, same definition, synonyms basically, curmudgeon, misanthrope. All of that, all of those are still accurate descriptors for Gus T. Part of that for counter-racism is frequently non-white people who speak about racism, white supremacy, especially if you strive to do so in an accurate manner, you will not be beloved and popular, certainly if you are still alive. Maybe once you are deceased and have been gone for a while, maybe we'll come back and, you know, decide that you are pretty cool after all. But while you're alive, we just finished up Paul Robeson, right? That has been my experience throughout this program. I think most of the time, that's probably a contributing factor with the whole brother and sister thing too, why I have no tolerance for people calling me that. But pretty consistently during my time hosting the broadcast here, the response from listeners, guests, everyone, it is not adoration or appreciation, which I'm not searching for. It is revulsion, disgust, hostility. That happened again this week. I'm just citing, this has been for the duration. It's lots of examples that I could cite. I could play sound clips. People who have called me names, threatened me on air during the program. I remember one from the very beginning. It's been this way. Noel Ignatieff, he wrote How the Irish Became White. He was a guest on the program in 2009 on the day Michael Jackson was buried. He was on the program. I thought he practiced racism. I said so while he was here. Cree, victim of racism. She said that one of her friends that she had not spoken to in a substantial amount of time, like this wasn't someone that, you know, they kicked it and talked on the phone or visited in person on a regular basis. If, unless my memory is bad, she said they had not spoken in some time. And she said he called her. And again, if memory is correct, she called, he called kind of late. This wasn't an afternoon Sunday chat. This was a kind of late call to talk for hours to basically say, man, I have heard some coons in my life. I've heard some coons, and then I heard that coon, Gus T. Renegade. Now, you let Noel Ignatieff, and that's a good white man, he called in to give accurate information, and that coon sat there and interrupted him and what accused him of being, what is a suspected racist? That is some high-level cooning right there. All he had to do was shut up and let that man talk. She said it was basically about 2 hours of that, which, again, I've heard that repeatedly. Remember Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. came on the air, cowbell, came on the air, threatened to punch me in the nose. Anyway, so this past Monday, we had Clifford Thompson on the program. That's another cowbell pattern. Woo! So we had Clifford Thompson on the program. What it is, I put the cowbell in the title for the program, and I put confusion is lethal. If people listen to the program, if anybody thought I was rude or discourteous, please make sure to share. That was not my goal. I did have a priority to make sure that I pointed out components of his work or his views that were not logical. Not to do so in a hostile or combative way. VGQ means victims guaranteed qualified. However, it is so common that individuals, racists, the people who are to blame for this are not Clifford Thompson, it's whites. But what they will do is amplify a victim of white supremacy and say, oh yeah, this here person is super informed about white supremacy racism. This here is an expert. Like, we white people, we are the biggest dunces about racism ever. But this here fellow right here, oh man, I learned everything. This is a PhD expert on racism. Take it away, Cliff. That's what they'll do. And then Clifford Thompson will come and say, you got victim elite. I'm the only non-racist black person. Lots of things of that nature in the text. So Mr. Thompson, he came on the program Monday. We did the broadcast. Some folks asked their questions. I asked my questions. He was not pleased by the time he left, which, you know, I kind of anticipated. He writes in after the program is over, and I'll make sure to time that. He writes in like minutes after the program is over. This is at about 8:30. He left us probably a little bit, I'd say approximately about 8:15 p.m. This past Monday. So he writes in and he says, I have to say that if I had known what the conversation was going to be like, I would not have agreed to it. I really do not know what your purpose was. I assume it was not to inform listeners about my book, because no one hearing about me for the first time on your program would have a good idea of what my book is about or what I set out to accomplish with it. Instead, you spent 2 hours plus picking at phrases in my book, trying to prove that I said things I didn't say and meant things I don't mean. If your purpose was to mischaracterize me and my work, then congratulations on a job well done. I will not even try to figure out why you insisted on talking about my wife, Cowbell, the way you did and mentioning her first and last name on the air. I'm going to pause again right there. His wife, Amy Peck, AmyPeck, is named in the book. In fact, oh, I'd pull it up right now. I have ebook. I'd have to open up my e-reader. She's named in the book. I'm literate, and I read the book from beginning to end. If you did not want your wife listed, and same thing I tell people on workplace racism. If you have anything you don't want to be publicized, I'm in a tragic arrangement, but I don't want to talk about that. I don't want Gus ringing the cowbell every time I go, cool in the game. You don't tell anybody. Now, once you start telling even one person, hey, be cool with everybody knowing that. If they want to bring it up and talk about it, fine. And you write a book about anything, you should for sure. How does Mr. Fuller say it? You should for sure be able to stand by your work. And I mean every single letter. My advice to you is to look deep inside yourself and ask what you are trying to accomplish with your work, because you are a singularly bad radio host. And that has been a lot of what it has been for 11 years. That right there is why. Do not call me brother. Do not. None of that black brother. Because I've seen where it can get to this very, very fast for any victim of racism. I do not think this is unique to me. This is Dr. Martin Luther King. This is Paul Robeson. This is Rosa Parks. Insert Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Insert name. You attempt to talk about racism, white supremacy, and do so in an accurate manner. This is the sort of commentary response that you can get. You cannot be worried about what people think, trying to make friends. Try your best to be accurate. I say that all the time. Strive for accuracy. Use logic. We are just trying to solve the problem of white supremacy, racism. Again, if anyone thinks I was discourteous in speaking with Mr. Thompson this past Monday, I definitely will be held accountable for that. If anyone thinks that I was rude, curt, could have or should have been more courteous with him, please share if you heard the broadcast. But I did want to make sure. I have a bunch of these type of emails. I could probably take up a whole program going through and reading emails from white and non-white guests where they have said similar things, sometimes with profanities and name calling, sometimes not. But the general gist. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943. Pound, press *61 if you would like to participate. Mr. Clifford Thompson, victim of white supremacy. I don't remember if he said that he wasn't a victim, so that's not name calling. That's just logic. Anybody that is classified as non-white, following logic. Victim of white supremacy, and if you're in a tragic arrangement, you are a victim of maximum racist aggression. Folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, thoughts, suggestions to share, *61, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Somebody has a handle of Adabinga. I cannot believe it. Wow. Reading is more important than watching television. He spent some time hanging out in the great state of Virginia, the Coon Man. I think he even died in Virginia. I have to go to double check to make sure I'm not inaccurate there, but the great Adabinga, late great Adabinga. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Hello, may I be heard?
Irie calling in from Cancer Alley.
Yes. Oh, it's not nothing to laugh at, but that's very sad because my family originates from St. James Parish. It's a couple hours drive from New Orleans, and actually still have some land there that is being processed for oil at a very, very, people are practicing racism on the older relatives in my family because what I found out is they're getting a very paltry amount for what's extracted per year. And I actually said something about it, and they were like, no, we're just going to stick with it because we just glad to have the deal, you know. And all of Louisiana, all of southern Louisiana is basically infiltrated with refineries, factories. It's really bad, and I'm just praying that whatever relatives I have that are still in St. James Parish, that they're, I don't know, that they're doing something to maintain their health. Breast milk. My grandmother, she had my mother in 1956 at an Air Force base. I don't remember which one, but she said she was on the Air Force base when she was married to my grandfather. And she said that the doctor gave her drying up pills. And she was like, I couldn't feed your mom for a long time. I couldn't figure out why. And then she said, I realized the pills they gave me must have been drying up pills. And because of her inability to breastfeed properly, because she was willing and ready to do so, my mother must have suffered some type of trauma in infancy that my grandmother mentioned and questioned aloud if that was a start to some mental health issues my mom had from her not being able to breastfeed properly. I was about to say, you mentioned something about Groundhog Day. No, absolutely not. That's not Groundhog Day. You know, when you continuously prosecute someone over and over and over again, it means that one way or another, you are willing to deplete resources just to prove a point to not just the non-white person you're prosecuting, but everyone else. We have every single opportunity and element to our disposal in the known universe will keep you here this, no matter what. And then to your interview with Mr. Clifford, whatever, I can't remember. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but, you know, I stated that I thought he was arrogant. You were about to say something?
That's the name, Thompson, Clifford Thompson.
Yeah, Mr. Thompson. I said he was arrogant. I do believe it still. So that's part of that reaction, you know, that ego. And I hope that's not, you know, symbolism. But, yeah, I think his ego was bruised because he was probably expecting, you know, an NPR style. You mentioned this, and what's that? And, you know, he says it, and then you just go to your next question without questioning him again or being thorough, and you're right. Why would he? He's so confused. He's confused about the fact that he wrote about his white wife in the book and said her whole name. That's something right there, and I'll mute my line for now.
It is. I don't know what that is either. I cannot imagine anything. I mean, if it was me writing a book, you know, when I was five, I wet the bed, and then someone come out in the public and say, oh man, didn't you wet the bed that time? Oh my God, what do you mean? Are you trying to humiliate me?
I thought you, it was on page 95. I read your book, Black Brother. Like, woo, VGQ. Folks, we have not heard from at all. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
I'll be here.
We just heard from Irie in Cancer Row, Louisiana. This is IV. Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Des, and greetings to all the callers on the line. About the term prejudice, it's interesting that Mr. Thompson has been brought up. You know, I think that that term is deceptive and that white people came up with that. The definition, so-called, of racism that they come up with, saying that it's prejudice to prejudge. That's not what this is at all. Like, it's not as though white people have prejudged their victims and decided that they deserve to be treated the way that we are treated. Like, racists, they're like rapists. Like, rapists, they don't prejudge their victims and then decide that they deserve to be raped. No, they decide that this is what they want to do for whatever it is, for whatever reason they want to do it, and they go and do it. That is what white people, that is what they do. This is not about that they like us or don't like us or they think this about us or think that about us. They don't care about any of that. They haven't, like, sat and analyzed what type of people we are and decided to mistreat us and to terrorize us on that basis. No, they're just terrorists. It's just like 9/11. They went and they knocked down the towers. They blew up the Pentagon or whatever you call that building or whatever, because that's what they wanted to do, not because they went and prejudged and decided that that's what those victims deserved and so this is what they were going to do. No, they did what they wanted to do. They decided they wanted to do something, they went and did it, and that is what white people do. As far as Mr. Foster, I think he's either white or Mexican. I don't know if anybody asked about whether or not he was black. They probably didn't, but if they did, I would say absolutely not. But he's probably either white or Mexican. That's what he looked like to me, one of the two. I think that Mr. Thompson, his main problem with the way that the interview went and some things that he said to you even in the letter was that I think he thought that the interview hurt his book sales. And I think that's also why he had such a visceral reaction when you said he had anti-black views, which he absolutely does. Because people, I think he even said in the letter that people ain't gonna listen to that interview and want to buy his book based off the things that was said. I think, and I don't say this to be disrespectful, and I hope I don't start this a pattern of disrespect toward him, because once you get to talking negatively about another, especially another black person, it becomes a pattern. But I think that when he said, you know, that you're a bad radio host, I think that that was extremely childish. And I would say it's false, but it's a matter of opinion. And my opinion is that you're the best radio host I ever heard in my life. This is the best program I've ever heard in my life. And I just wanted to ask a question. Well, first of all, everybody have as great a weekend as they can have, but I just want to ask a question, Gus. Obviously, you do get positive feedback. I wanted to know how much positive feedback do you get overall and have you gotten over the years in comparison to negative feedback? Would you say it's like 90-10, you know, negative or positive, whatever? Like, if you had to kind of put some numbers on it or kind of give an idea in terms of comparison. And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Doug.
Much obliged, Ivy. It's difficult to quantify, you know, like, obviously there have been, we wouldn't be on the air if
Most of the people who listened to the program thought that the cows was not constructive because we are listener supported. So, you know, we would have been gone a long time ago. And another reason it's hard to say is because, and this is in the archives too, one of the things that will happen, as I've said before, it's impossible to find two victims of racism who have uniform views about every aspect of white supremacy racism. I don't know anybody. Nobody on this line, nobody that's been a guest on this program, not a family member, a friend, not one person where it's, oh yeah, we have total agreement about every aspect of white supremacy racism and what we think should be done to solve this problem. As such, it's likely you'll have disagreements with people from time to time. And with victims of racism, as you said, sometimes it can easily become more intense than it should, given what the real problem is, who the real problem is. So sometimes people will appreciate the cow. Sometimes it'll even happen with guests where they'll come on at the beginning and it'll be great. Mr. Thompson, we start out adversarial. He was okay, even with going back, prejudice, racism. Wait a minute, those, you're not really getting to the question. And then by the time we've done 2 hours, yeah, this is the greatest coon in the world, and I am so sorry that I've been here. Like, that happens a lot, even with listeners, where they'll appreciate the program, and they'll get upset about something, a guest, or anything, system of racism, and they'll be upset, and they'll stop listening. And even some people have said that they'll stop listening, and they'll come back. They'll say, Gus is the biggest coon in the world. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm not listening to that foolishness anymore. And they'll leave. And then something will happen, be like, oh, man, maybe he wasn't a coon, maybe. Maybe he was. They'll come back and they'll start listening again. So it's difficult to say. I would just tell people, I think the way that my final conclusion was, regardless of what they think about your work and what you do, you are always about 5 minutes, and I mean this literally, you are always about 5 minutes away from being Coon of the Week. So, yeah, you can take all of the compliments or what have you. It should not mean a whole lot. Don't take it too personal. The problem is still white people. You're probably going to be called a whole lot of names, and people will have a lot of unpleasant things to say about your efforts to solve this problem. That is a part of the counter-racist job description. Did that answer the question?
I don't know, but I want to try one more time to maybe put it this way. Would you say that it's been mostly negative, mostly positive, or you just don't know?
I really don't. I would have to go. I mean, and even trying to qualify. Now, what is positive? Is it positive if they shared the program? Is it positive if they called in? Is it positive if they called in and called me Black Brother? Like, what counts as positive? And then what counts as negative? Do they have to call your name and that sort of thing? It would be really difficult to qualify. Certainly, like, we would not be here if there were not people who disagreed with Mr. Thompson's view at some level. We would not be on the air. So there are certainly folks who have appreciated what we are doing, but there are a lot of people, and I suspect some of it is Dr. Welsing used to talk about that. People would get upset with her, and I've heard people get hostile with her, you know, on programs, and she's talked about people in person. We get mad with her about her views and that sort of thing, and then they would come back sometime later and say, man, I thought you were crazy, and wow, now I get it. Now I'm starting to understand what you were talking about. And even Pam said that. She said she heard some of the things Mr. Puller said, and it upset her. I think that happens a lot of times, too, where having truth revealed can be very upsetting. So, again, just try not to take it personal as best you can. I'm not really sure in terms of the numbers, positive, negative. I'm not sure. I guess it's been probably about a lot of both for us to be here 11 years at this point. It's probably been a lot of both.
Yeah, it sounds like from what all that you said that it's more like half and half. But at least you don't have it to where you absolutely know that it's been mostly negative. And what I mean by negative, where people consider or say that it's constructive, and that, or that it's not constructive, and that positive would be that they say that it is constructive. But again, as long as it's not, you know for sure that it's mostly negative. It does sound more like a half and half, but thank you for answering my question. I'll mute my line.
Mm-hmm. Context of white supremacy. Other folks we have not heard from, much obliged, Ivy in Irie, other folks who are with us.
Copy her.
Thomas, yes. In New York. Make sure you got your proof of payment for the subway.
Oh, sure, Gus. Man, I think I reported before some of the racist tactics they use to manipulate the machine so that people will hop, and then they will then arrest them for hopping, but all caused by them. Gun museum. The only thing white people revere more than guns is their other more modern weapons. You know, they convert aircraft carriers into museums and forts into parks. They got an atomic bomb museum in Japan. Like, if that doesn't show you white power, it's not a global system, okay. Boston Dynamic Robots. That's a joint project between Google and DARPA, even though SoftBank owns the company now, but that's where it started out. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The dog Spot, that's going to be a police dog, is nothing compared to their other robot that they're very hard to get a glimpse of. And every time they show you another video, they've so far advanced from the last video. It's like, oh, my God. Nothing at all. They have a few dog-like robots that are much bigger than Spot. They got a cat robot that runs 80 miles an hour. That was 2 years ago, so it's probably twice as fast now. It's like a cat. They call it Cheetah. They got a few size android robots. Android means human-like. They got arms and legs and stuff like that. And they put a video out last year of this thing doing a backflip and landing on its feet from about a 10-foot high, you know, incline. So very advanced, you know, very, very advanced. And they have one android one with wheels. They have a few of these things that look, they go from like, they look like vehicles. They go from the size of a remote control car, and that thing could jump a six-story building. Last time they put out a video, it probably jumps a 12-story video building now. And they have them as big as like one of those smart cars, those little smart cars, but those look like tinks. And they have a tink cannon on them, fully autonomous, meaning self-thinking. You know, that's the type of artificial intelligence they have in them. The person will not be operating them. They'll be thinking for themselves. Tulsa, not a race riot, a racist riot. You know, it doesn't appear to be, you know, that word race, you know. Nah, it was a racist riot, you know, killing black people. This white lady, white girl, Tessa Majors, stabbed and murdered suspected white supremacists here in New York. She went to Columbia University. They have a 14, two people they arrested and one person they're looking for. 13 and 14-year-old black children allegedly stabbed her to death for her iPhone or an alleged probably weed transaction, according to the media. That's two stories that they came out with. Today, the NYPD released a photo of the third 14-year-old male they're looking for, or they allege to be a suspect in this. And that's totally against protocols to put out a picture of a minor. So the media asked the new chief of police they just put in place a few weeks ago about the reason they did this, they didn't follow protocol, and he said to prevent another Central Park jogger case. And then he used a metaphor. He says he doesn't want to see these kids get railroaded. He doesn't want to see these kids get railroaded. He said that a few times. And it seems like, you know, they're already railroading, or should I say, not using the metaphor he used, practicing injustice against these kids by the fact they put his picture out. But when he started talking about the particular details of the case, they went from kids to young men right away. So kind of shows me where they're going with this whole thing. An Iowa man sentenced to 15 years in prison after burning an LGBT flag hanging on a church. His name is Adolfo Martinez, so he's not a white person. At least he didn't look like one to me, but he's not black. But he was found guilty Wednesday of tearing down and burning a flag, which was flying at this church. He faces 15 years in prison. They charged him with a hate crime and an arson as well. So for burning an LGBT flag, you get 15 years, man. You know, nothing compared to what they do to us. I sent you an article, Gus, this week. UN peacekeepers fathered hundreds of babies with girls in Haiti as young as 11. Said studies were based on the conversations of over 2,500 Haitians who shared experiences of women and girls in their communities that hosted the peace operations. 2,500 talked to, 10% revealed stories of the peacekeepers' father and children. Girl as young as 11 was allegedly sexually abused, impregnated by peacekeepers, and left to in misery. They put that in quotes to raise the children alone. So they're still not giving an accurate number, which you know they can give. You could probably just walk around the village and pick them out. But my very last thing I'm going to say, I know I'm running low on time. Cop will do less than 2 years for on-duty sexual assault of 16 women and won't have to register as a sex offender as part of plea deal. Reminded me of whole school. Doesn't say if these victims are black or non-white. However, the cop is white, and I assume if he was raping 16 or assaulted 16 white women, he would not be getting off. So I assume these were either black or non-white women, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Wow. Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Now, take that incident in New York. They gave whatever reason. That's even curious there to say they didn't want another Central Park 5. That's what I mean about the metaphors. Like, what does that mean? But anyway, they put the photo out. Now, they just had that incident in Georgia with that white girl, 16 years old, who was going to go and have a terrorist attack on a black church. She had went to the church, planned it out, had, you know, her everything written out, had her manifesto and everything. I'm a be the next Dylann Roof, the female version, white woman, white man. They didn't even release her name, much less a photograph. And she had a terrorist attack planned on a church. System of white supremacy. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if we have not heard from you at all, star 61.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. No, I don't think you were in any way discourteous with the non-white black male guest who was married to a white woman. If anything, all of us should have been more insistent upon speaking about the person that he chose as a wife. Well, I don't know if he chose her or not, but he is committed to her. And according to the interview, it was a volunteer situation. But we should have been more insistent upon speaking about her. We don't have any pact with any white person. We have a codified relationship with non-white people like himself, but not her. And she's not a child. She's not a child. And if she was a child, that would be a non-white person, from my understanding. She's not a child at all. So she can speak for herself if she don't like it or whatever, that sort of thing. And no, you were not discourteous towards him. Just a substitute the letter was just a substitute from just ending the phone call himself, which he didn't want to do, I guess. Coach Boone, I had similar experiences with coaches when I was in high school. Well, at least the first coach at the high school that I attended, basically the same situation for the same circumstances. Primarily when they put a black male as the head football coach at a high school under those sort of circumstances of racism and white supremacy, his job is to police quote unquote, police the non-white black students on campus. That's primarily what that person does. I have actually attended a football clinic where Mr. Boone was the speaker. He's not a large person, but you can tell he is very authoritative and can get people to do things. That type of person. He is the person that was the head football coach at the high school that I attended was a very, very big black male. Basically that's what he did. He placed the black males in a situation where he had them under control on the campus, quote unquote. Coached with a black male that wasn't necessarily exactly like that, but he was much more nicer person. But anyway, DCS program, last but not least, DCS program. Today we went over again the documentary on Emmett Lewis Till with this newer session. And we also had them to look up the meaning of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words: impeachment, self-love, discipline, undiscipline, and quiet. And I asked them, once they looked up the meanings, to give me the scientific term, but at the same time express the word in a means of their choice that would give all of us the understanding that they know what the word actually means. And that's basically what I have to say for this evening. Thank you.
Words are extremely important. Love it. Love it. Love it. That is spectacular.
And I didn't allow them to use the word impeachment in the same means that the present president is being spoken about, you know, right now. I didn't allow them to use that particular term. That's too easy. I wanted them to express the word impeachment in a different way. And they did. Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Retired firefighter in Florida. Much obliged. Others who we have missed totally. If you have comments, suggestions, questions, proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. They were great, very instructive clips. The gun museum, that seemed, you know, something that they would do. In fact, I was talking to my uncle about Civil War reenactments and how they love those things. And, I don't understand it. But, you know, that's what they enjoy to do, the gun, the fighting, the guns. They white people seem to love to enjoy that. As Mr. Fuller Jr. said, white people kill for fun. I think he said it. I heard you said it. I think you said he said it. I don't know. What if you said it? The conversation with Mr. Thompson, it seemed like every other conversation. Now, to me, sometimes they do seem rough because I know this is usually a black person, and I don't think I think usually when they call, they may not their understanding is different than ours, but you have to learn and go through those things, and sometimes they're not fun, they're painful, or they're not as enjoyable as you think they could be. But I always think that they're constructive. And if I ask a black person a question on the air, I try to ask something not involving, especially Area 8, because I know it can get especially contentious. And I try to get something where I know I can get concrete, because I know it's concrete, but a definitive answer and best I can. Now, for white people, I'm not really concerned about their feelings or anything at that time. but I know the black person is, I truly believe that they're doing the best that they can, and, you know, they're just things that they may not think about. They're things that I do that I'm sure I don't think about. So I try to be, as you said, be patient with, you know, other black people. But, you know, the questions do need to be answered. So I do appreciate the program and the fact that the questions are answered. Sometimes I say things and people get upset with what I say, or I may not agree with everything. But I trust that when I'm listening to this program, everyone's heart is really trying to help solve the problem. And there is a caring, because you're taking a lot of time out to listen to this program. And I know you say you're a curmudgeon and all this, but it takes a lot of dedication and, dare I say, love for helping us solve this problem, to go through all the work that you go through and listen to all the awful clips, like especially about those children who were taken away from their parents and not named properly and allowed to grow with their family. You know, those are horrible things to listen to, and the fact that you continue to do that year after year to help us all, even help us all, I should say, help us all solve this problem is, you know, it's, to me, is remarkable. I want to get the heart to do things like that. But, you know, I try. Hopefully I'm getting better. So I try. Again, good clips, good program. And I was just thinking, I don't know what the next book you're going to read. And I know I don't listen to the book club all the time, but I know we talk about asking questions. I don't know if someone has read a book on that. I think maybe that would be a good book for us to learn, you know, to go through, say, okay, you know, so that when we ask questions to people, sometimes we can maybe ask them a little smooth and, I guess, more palatable way so that we can still get the answer we want. Like, for example, one person asked me one time, did I miss them? And I could have said, no, I don't miss you. I just told them it wasn't the same without them. They went away happy. I went away happy. They felt whatever they felt. Of course, this was a black person, so I wasn't trying to definitely hurt their feelings. But, you know, they felt, they went away with a smile. I went away with a smile. You know, they believed what they believed, and I kept it moving. Thank you. That was all.
Much obliged. I am certain there are books written about asking questions. I know there are, because for people that do interviews, I've looked at some of them. For people that do interviews, they have books on how you can get better at giving interviews and better questions to ask and all of that. They absolutely do. I have to go back and look. Some of that is in, like, they have general books about communication too, like verbal self-defense. That's the one we talked about. Verbal judo. I have it here. I have to look in my library. But I think it's verbal self, the art of verbal self. Oh, well, I can see it from here. I can see it. Verbal self-defense. That's it. They have books like that. And the whole book won't be about asking questions per se, but a lot of it is still relevant, because it'll be about, like, what you, the example that you just gave, where the person, did you miss me? Wasn't the same without you. Able to use words to minimize conflict and to help you kind of navigate situations better. There are lots of books like that. Lots of them. So it would just be a matter of picking one out. Even though I was kind of thinking we should maybe read that Tulsa book, but lots of options. The Death in a Promised Land on the Tulsa terrorism, white supremacy. But we got time to pick something. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, *61.
Can I be heard?
Mr. Mhandisi, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings, and greetings to everyone. I want to start with saying I'm an American. And the other thing I wanted to say was to Mr. Fuller, let me pull this email. Sorry. Okay. So my email to Mr. Fuller was, and the reason I read it is because I still didn't get a full answer. Last week you suggested black people possibly could choose to preserve white people's genetic state of albinism in exchange for white people ending white supremacy. I've heard Dr. Welsing say something similar. You also stated that white people may, however, have ulterior motives and not accept our offer at all. If we choose to preserve white people's genetic state of albinism in exchange for white people ending white supremacy, what time frame will this take place? What date do we make the offer? How much time from the initial offer is to pass before we decide that white people have ulterior motives or that they have accepted our offer? Hopefully you were able to hear that. I had to pull my phone from my face to read that. Anyway, Mr. Fuller, I appreciate you continuing to engage me in conversation. But I want to say, without a time frame, the second portion of what you said doesn't make sense, because, okay, you said that we need to preserve white people's genetics. Well, that's already being done. So, but then you're saying, well, at some point, we have to decide, well, are white people killing black people because they want to preserve their genetics? Or are white people killing black people for another reason? But in order to find that out, there would have to be a time frame. But if there's no time frame, then we just continue this perpetually forever. But that's already what there is. So there has to be a time frame. There has to be a time that we decide. What are white people doing? Are they killing us because they have to do it for this reason, or are they killing us for this reason? And then what do we do about it? And I know none of us really know what to do about it. But there has to be a time frame for such suggestions. And I would say, if we were to choose to preserve white people's genetics, white people's genetic state of albinism, because white people will not go extinct. How when there's white people living in all the black people that they've raped? You know, how can they go extinct? You mean white people won't be albinos no more? That's what we're talking about. So, you know, anyway, but if that's what we're going to choose to do, help white people stay albinos forever, then they cannot be here in America. Actually, no matter what, they cannot be here in America. They cannot be in Africa. They cannot be in Australia. They cannot be in South America, which is America. They cannot be in our areas or in our land, period. However, if we're talking about preserving white people's genetics, then absolutely they cannot be here. Then what's the time frame? 6 months. I gave a year. It didn't matter. 6 months. This could be done in 6 months. They can leave America. They can leave Australia. They can leave Africa. And they can go back to their land. They have a low birth rate because they left the area that they're from. And they spread themselves out. Aside from their genetics as albinos, as, you know, that's why they have a low birth rate. But because they've spread themselves out so much, if they go back to where they're from and leave us, then they can work on their birth rate. They can stay albinos forever or until they don't. There's no more albinos, whatever. But we can put a time frame to it. We can do this in 6 months. I think we can do this in 6 months. I'm sure we can do this in 6 months. And then I wanted to say, yeah, okay, that'll be it. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. Other folks who dialed in, I think white people, just attempting to follow logic myself, and again, VGQ, attempting to follow logic myself, I think, or I'll say it this way, I've concluded that individuals classified as white do not need assistance preserving their genetics. If that's something that they wanted to do, they could do that easily. They don't need our help with that. That's my conclusion. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally, the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Broadcast not for spectators. Other folks, or rather, if you're on the line, if we haven't heard from you and you think you might have a question, suggestion, comment to offer, please don't wait until the very final moment. Go ahead and get that hand up so that we can hear what you have to say. Other folks that we've missed totally.
May I be heard?
Truck driver in Houston, Texas. Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I just had two quick things. One was the guest who was on, Mr. Clark. when he was on, while I was listening, because I didn't catch it live, but as the program kept going, and the more I kept listening, it almost was insulting. Just his responses to just some of the questions that that you guys were asking, and the second thing is, I have a question for you. What is it that when non-white people are in sexual relationships with white people, that kind of but they get these kind of mixed up ideologies in terms of, I guess, the reasoning that for them doing what they're doing, because to all of us it's incorrect, but for some reason, when a non-white victim is in a sexual relationship with a white person, it always is kind of off. Now, I know you might have explained it in some episodes in the past in the archives, but maybe you can help me out a little bit, because I have a very, very good friend of mine who was in a couple of tragic arrangements and actually had, you know, children. And you try to throw a little, you know, give little tidbits to him to kind of help him out. But, you know, he looks at you and say, "Hey, man, which are you racist?" And he'd be like, "No, you know, I'm just trying to see what made you decide to go, you know, that route." And that's all I have. Maybe you could help me out.
Much obliged, good sir. we have talked about that, man. Oh, man. Talk about 11 years. We have covered that quite a bit. Pam, she was mentioned already. Her book, The Interracial Con Game, she talks about it quite a bit there. We've talked about it on this. Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., I've written about it, Interracial Relationships Are Sad, where it covers a lot of what you just said. In fact, we've talked about this so much on the program. There are very few subject matters where I feel like, wow, we've done, you know, at least a moderately adequate job of covering that subject matter. Like, very few. And system of racism is still here, so obviously there's lots of work to be done. Area 8, that is not one. I feel like, wow, we really have not covered. We have covered all of that. In fact, we've done such a great job. We don't talk about Area 8 on the compensatory call-in, because I've noted that will just dominate. People will just talk about that and talk about that and talk about that, and I have a suspicion that it's not always constructive. Sometimes it's more entertaining to talk about that than to talk about them putting a cemetery on a black burial ground. That's my conclusion. But you can look on my blog, Interracial Relationships Are Sad. That talks exactly about what you're saying. Pam's book, The Interracial Com Game. You can look at any of the broadcasts that are listed with that book title. That's going to be specifically about that subject matter. Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. If you click the article that I mentioned, The Interracial Con Game, there are links to specific programs, W. Kamau Bell, and many others, where that topic is discussed in general, and you'll see the same pattern and why that pattern is there. But yes, the Cows has done lots and lots and lots of work over the decade on that subject matter specifically. Let's see. Other folks, we have missed totally. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Quick. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, callers. Greetings, Jack, Gus, and all the listeners. Again, I think the show Watchmen, definitely worth staying, definitely have to stay away from. I've had to come to my own conclusion in regards to a lot of films and any media that has a lot of non-white people in it. It's difficult to watch, and it's hard to actually even decipher some of the things that are going on and why things are done within those shows, because it'll also confuse you as well as leave you in a kind of a depressed state. I recently saw, and I'm bringing up a film, but just to put it into context, I recently saw Queen and Slim, a popular movie right now, and I would suggest not watching it. You're not going to leave the movie theater in any positive mood at all. Going forward, in regards to New York City, as far as the fair hiking or the watching the fairs, there is actually a group out here in New York City that did a large protest in November in regards to that. Unfortunately, I don't remember the lady's name. She actually is an advocate for families and for police violence. She's really pushing the envelope, and she's been stating that the city is now plugging more money into this, but mainly in sections that are non-white. So in areas that are predominantly Black, Harlem, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, East New York, all these places that are heavily, densely populated with non-white people, mainly Black, not Asian non-white communities, but predominantly Black areas. They are actually putting more police in those areas. So if you go to white areas in just another couple of blocks over, you won't see any police or any slave catchers in that area, which she definitely brought up. I'll try to email you her information. She's definitely an interesting person to interview. She was interviewed on Black Agenda. In regards to Mr. Clark, it was very difficult to listen to his answers.
Thompson? Clifford Thompson? Clifford Thompson, just making sure.
Yes, Thompson. Pardon. It was difficult to listen to his answers. I think Ivy expressed it very well. I think she stated that he came across very arrogant. And in the book, the signs of his arrogance kept on popping up. And it's amazing. I guess writing is obviously therapeutic, but it also releases and says a lot about your character. And as you stated earlier, every letter, every word, and the fact that throughout the book you were able to pull up instances where he's stating, I felt more empowered. I felt better than my Black friends because I wasn't racist like them. And it was almost like he was passing judgment to say, well, I'm up here and I'm better than you because I don't have those same preconceived notions. But then when he was asked questions about should it be okay for non-white people to have a healthy suspicion of white people, he tiptoed around the question and couldn't give a direct answer. And then the following caller asked the same question. And then he said, yeah, it's kind of okay. The reality is you pushed him to actually ask to be honest about his work, to be truthful about the things that he's promoting within his work. And he didn't want to stand by it because he knew what he was writing was incorrect. You know, VGQ, we're all still learning. We're all still going through these cycles, but it was a little difficult. And it reminded me of another, I forgot her name. You interviewed her quite a few times, I think two or three, but she was poking fun at the fact that she did not like hanging around Black people. And she had a YouTube and video and everything. And you had her on and interviewed her. And she was a Black female. And she even had a video and a song about
Oreo experience.
All I Want for Christmas. Thank you. That's when I was listening to him talk. He seemed like, and I'm trying not to call names, but he seemed like the male version of it, like in a different, refined way. It's difficult. And again, we're all going through our own struggles. This time of the year is very difficult. And I'll just say this to everybody. Do the best you can to be patient with all your family and friends, because everybody around this time of year feels some certain type of pressure. So just do your best to hang in there and be the best counter-racist you can be. All right? I'll mute my line. Thank you, guys.
Hang in there is a metaphor. definitely. Patience with other victims if you're doing the so-called holiday stuff. Absolutely. Patience. With other victims, maybe even do some breathing exercises. If it gets rowdy, somebody is about to be struck or cursed or hit, things could get volatile. Just do a few breathing exercises. Just calm down. You don't have to do all the vigorous yoga. Just do some breathing. Sit quietly. See if that helps restore order. Or at least you personally can do breathing exercises. Even if you can't make it a group activity, you can at least be calm yourself. Model constructive behavior. Other folks that we missed totally, *61 again, don't wait till the last moment if you're with us. If we missed you totally, speak up. Make sure you don't wait till the last minute.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller and four.
Hello?
I heard you, sir. We'll get our caller in Florida, and then we will get you as well.
Yes, yes. I was going to comment on what you were talking about.
Hang on a second, sir. We'll get our caller in Florida, and then we'll get you as well.
Oh, yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to us, the host, the listeners, and callers. There was a segment, a part of the audio segment, where I think the four children were born and all named Mary. I think it got to toward the end of the segment where someone was being interviewed, and I don't know if that was a white person that mentioned that all four of the siblings, the sisters, was diagnosed with cancer, and to give an answer that she didn't know what was the catalyst or the cause for it. I think that was an act of racism, in my opinion, because I just couldn't think how couldn't they have figured that out. Like, how couldn't they have known what was the cause of it? I don't know. Maybe it was because of diet or maybe other reasons, but I don't know if that person was in the medical field or whatnot. My next one is it looks like that was the Young Turks, and the male host definitely sound like that was being phony. Made it seem like he was very interested in how black people are being treated. He was using the term, I think, black African-American, and then he turned to say, it's just disgusting, I think, how minorities are treated. But he wasn't using the word minority before. Okay, and then he said, we really got to really come together and deal with this monstrosity, then say racism. So it's definitely a concentrated effort to avoid using the term racist, racism, or white supremacy. I did see a video. It is the area of entertainment, but Dr. Wilson's book was being read by Nick Cannon in a video where he made a track against Eminem, and he showed the page of the phallus and the gun, and I thought that was interesting. I had never seen that before. And the video, of course, had 59,000 thumbs down. So, and my last one is, there is an author. I don't know if anyone's heard of this author. I think his name is Ibram X. Kendi or something like that. The city uploaded the author's visit to the public library just a little while ago. So I think it's called How to Be an Anti-Racist. It's a black male author. I was going to look at that visit that he had on the YouTube page, and I was going to get back to everyone with my thoughts on it. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Give us the update, please.
Excuse me, Gus. What, can I ask the caller again? What was that author's name? I think I've heard of him as well. He has a book. Gosh, he has another book about being labeled at birth as a less than human as well. What is his name again?
I believe it's Ibram X. Kendi. I believe it's I-B-R-A-M X-K Kendi, K-E-N-D-I?
Yes, the book is called Stamp. Yes, the book is called Stamp. He was on NPR as well. His work seems pretty relevant. I didn't get a chance to read the book Stamp from beginning. It's a definitive history of racist ideas in America. But he does have some good historical notes in that book from what I've read a little bit of it so far.
Hang on a second. You already got to speak. I thought you were the caller we missed before. Hang on one second.
Sorry about that.
Not a problem. Caller at 4499. I was going to say, though, he's a victim of racism. Ibram X. Kendi. I hope I'm saying his name correctly. However, what was just said, he was on NPR. He has been everywhere. He's probably been here in Seattle, too, just like Clifford Thompson was NPR. Same trend that I have noted. Many of the non-white people who whites aggressively promote, because I don't remember Dr. Welsing's NPR interview. I don't remember Mr. Fuller's NPR interview. I don't remember Dorothy Roberts' NPR interview. I don't even remember Harriet Washington's NPR interview. And I think all of them have super constructive work on racism, white supremacy, but they get Clifford Thompson promoted consistently. That's why I point out I am substantially suspicious of anybody, white or non-white. If a lot of white people are aggressively promoting their work about racism, and particularly if the person is still alive, like, oh wow, because it's very rare that I see a book that gets heavily promoted about racism that is actually accurate and constructive. Very, very rare. Folks, we have missed totally. That's how I wanted the update. The caller, 4499. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I was just going to give a comment. This week, my mother called me. This is on how you say how victims' relationships can get difficult and just, you know, whatever. But she calls me late night and says, you know, Trump's been impeached. I told her, I said, I'll believe it when I see it. He's going to be a two-term president. She hung up on me, and I haven't heard from her since. It's just, you know, that's how the system is. But just my comment for the week.
I'm sorry that happened. That's not funny. I mean,
no, it isn't. But, you know, just how the system is, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was thinking, I don't have anything. I said the entire time, the only thing I have to say about President Trump, the election, the impeachment, anything pertaining to any of those subjects, 4 more years. Same thing I've been saying since the night he won in 2016. 4 more years. And in fact, I'm thinking, you know, hey, I know some people, we predicted Trump 2016, predicted Andrew Gillum was going to lose the election at the end of about this time last year, predicted he was going to lose, that Governor Santorum would be next in office. You can wager on that. I know some Cows listeners wagered on the Florida governor's race for last year, and they did win. Gus T, right on. I say, hey, what's the Vegas line on Trump 4 more years? What's the Vegas line? He is a prohibitive favorite. You wouldn't even make any money betting on him in Vegas. Like, it's no drama. This is theater. We talk about racial theater. This will be theater. So we can all get our popcorn and sit around and tweet and watch. And then all of this will conclude with whomever the candidate is 4 more years. Unless I've been in error. Other folks, but I am sad that your mother. Confusion is lethal. When you don't understand, that's why Mr. Fuller said, when you don't understand racism, white supremacy, everything else that you understand, think you understand, will only confuse you. White people do a very good job. And with this, they'll get to pretend that all of the individuals classified as white that want President Trump out of office, these are the good, not racist white people. And all of the white people who say that they want Trump, those are the only racist white people. That's the way, so that the Young Turks and all of these, Bernie Sanders, Clintons, all of that. Oh, yeah, we are not racist. We read How to Be an Anti-Racist. We love Jane Elliott. And we definitely, definitely no more Trump in 2020. Anybody but him. Anybody but him. Don't be fooled. Four more years. Anybody we missed totally? Do we get everybody? Is anybody that has not been able to talk at all? Spectacular. Irie, did you have something else you were going to get in?
I forgot to mention that colostrum is something found in breast milk, and it just proves how important breastfeeding is, that colostrum is sold as a supplement for adults to take. I'm not sure exactly sure what it does, but I forgot to mention that earlier. I wanted to also tell Thomas that there's a Vice documentary I saw on YouTube about smart weapons, and I think you'll find it interesting because there are people that are considered headliners, or I don't know what the word, the experts, there you go. They'd be considered like premier experts in the field of, firearms, and they were threatened, and I'm assuming by white people, for wanting to even attempt to put out smart firearms. And there's also a book about China and their technological advances that they're using to try to overcome the United States as the supreme authority on surveillance. And I believe the name of the book is 33 Principles. And I could be wrong, and I'm going to double check, and I'll email the title to Gus if I am wrong. And the last thing, Gus, I wanted to tell you, but then ask. So I'm a part of a parent committee that they're looking for a white speaker to talk specifically to the white people about racism and how it works, like they don't know. And one of the non-white people suggested, guess who? Tim Wise. Of course, I'm not with that based on the interviews I've listened to on the cows. So the question I have in turn is Mr. Ayers, is Mr. Bill Ayers, would he be a better alternative for us to think about, or who do you think would be constructive that's white to talk to white people about their behaviors?
Wow. I'm not even sure I can think of anyone that... would do any constructive work. Definitely would not recommend Tim Wine. Even the whole premise, I would start with the whole premise is just as you did. I reject the notion that white people need a refresher course on racism. And I also reject that white people should get these type of jobs to Jane Elliott, Tim Wise, where they can make $10,000 to go and waste time talking about racism as though white people don't already know this information. So, yeah, if that's already that's not up for debate or reconsideration, I probably wouldn't have any input on it at all. I would feel like it would be consuming my time and energy, and they're going to make the decision about who they want to bring anyway. And I can't really, if you all have heard a whole lot of white people here, there's not one person that I can think of and be like, oh yeah, you should have Dr. Kevorkian or Jane Elliott.
It's not written in stone. That's why I was thought maybe I'd ask, because I did listen to the interview you did with Mr. Ayers, or however you say his last name, and it sounded good at first, like he was all, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, but then toward the middle and the end, it was like, no, you still, you racist suspect. So I'm stumped. I don't know. Well, I'm confused. I don't know who to suggest, and I probably won't make any suggestions then. But if they get Tim Wise, I'm going to let them know that I'm off the committee, because I'm not co-signing that.
I would maybe see if you could ask a question. I always recommend that. Now, if they bring a white person, if you're present, if you're able to be present, I don't know if he's just going to talk to white people, but if you can be present, I would certainly ask a question. Let them pick whoever they want, and then, you know, if I can ask one good question, great, outstanding. Maybe see if that, if I can ask one good question to disrupt everything in a constructive manner. But, yeah, I don't know how much of my time and energy I would put into that, because I just can't think of, and even the white people who have had more constructive information to offer here, they would sound very different if they are now amongst all of their peers, white women and white men, and they don't have, like, you're not there facilitating. Like, I suspect you would just be there in the audience as a spectator listening to whatever this person is going to say. It's not like you can get up and redirect with them when they start just not answering questions or being dishonest about things. So it's generally speaking, it's not a situation that's going to work out favorably for non-white people. Whites will be able to do whatever they want, practice racism, make money while they do it. Anybody have?
And I just want to tell everybody, have a safe trip in Florida. If we don't talk before the holidays.
We'll be here tomorrow. Rethinking Rufus, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Did anybody have a suggestion? A white person that you think might be worth hiring to come speak to other white people about racism? Yeah, I couldn't think of one either. If you think of one, maybe you can email us and let us know if you take some time to ponder on it. Other folks who had comment, question, anything they wanted to get in, last few minutes, we have about a little less than 15 minutes at this point. If you have other questions, comments you want to share before we conclude.
Can I be heard? You can go.
Okay, thanks, Amon DC. So about Mr. Thompson and his wife Amy Peck in a book. She was in the acknowledgement. I haven't read the book, but I did see that on Google Books, and even on page 88 is when he talked about the black woman who frowned at the two of them. He has a lot of things in that book where he has a lot of anecdotes that are of black people doing negative things, whether it be judging him for spending time with racists or whatever it might be. And I find it interesting as well that he admired the race soldier who called Will Chamberlain a nigger, but yet victims of racism who want to exclude racists, they get called names like victim elite. So we get name calling, but the racists who do the name calling, calling people niggers, they get admiration. So I find that interesting. I think the woman who suggested, I think this is what she suggested, that we read a book about asking questions. I think that is brilliant. There was a toothless race soldier. I was in the drive-thru for the bank, and she intentionally took the cup out of the machine where you have to put your debit card in there for you to do transactions if you want to do it to the drive-thru. So she did that on purpose to just make things more inconvenient, and then she came up to me and gave the cup back and all that. I say that to say they try to talk about how, you know, if you're toothless or if you're not all that literate or whatever the case may be and you're white, you know, that you don't know, you're too dumb to practice racism. You may be dumb, but that's probably about the only thing that you do know. You know that if you don't know anything else. And I just wanted to ask you, Gus, real quick, if you ever noticed this pattern and what you think it is about. A pattern that I've noticed from people who have white parents, from people who have non-black parents, whether it be an Asian parent or a white parent or just some parent who isn't non-black, who is non-black, they constantly point out the misconduct of black people. They always saying black people doing this and black people doing that, even when they consider themselves black, and they say we do this and we do that. But they don't never have anything negative to say. They don't have anything to say about the misconduct of
the group that their non-black parent is in. So they rarely, if ever, have anything negative to say about, you know, white people if their parent is black, or Asian people if their parent is Asian, or whatever the non-black classification is. So I just wanted to know if you noticed that pattern, and if you know, or if you have an idea as to why that could be, because, you know, you study racism, and in my opinion, you do it very well. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus, and thanks, M on DC.
Much obliged, Ivy. I think that pattern, or I'll say it this way, I think the anti-blackness is pretty rife within the system, where lots of black people are encouraged to think poorly about other black people. I can certainly see how in those type of arrangements, just the power dynamic where you, and in a lot of those situations also, the power dynamic, the offspring end up with the white parent, especially if it's a black father or white mother, the offspring ends up with the white parent. Where they end up having much more sway over that child's thoughts, behaviors, and they're not talking about racism. That's another pattern that we've observed. So you put all of that together, the confusion is astronomical. And frequently, because of the isolation in those environments, you're probably not going to be getting a lot of contact with black people to have black self-respect, so that you have a really high opinion of black people. That's probably not going to be happening if you're in that type of arrangement. If you're the offspring, especially, because that suspected race soldier parent is going to have a lot of control over the material that you're exposed to, the people that you're exposed to, the ideas that you're exposed to, in addition to a lot of other things. So it's a lot that goes into that. But I mean, anti-blackness is not easy to produce. Let's see. Imhan DC, thank you for your patience, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I wanted to say, as far as security and being safe, I would suggest that people walk in twos or more. Don't walk by yourself. And be careful about walking at night. Don't walk at night if you don't have to. And don't even walk if you don't have to in certain instances. But walk, of course, that's healthy, but be careful about your surroundings. Know how many people are in your 360 degree field of view. So at any given time, as you are being throughout the day, you should know how many people, if you were to turn your head in 360 degrees, you should know without turning your head how many people are all around in your field of view. Let's see. Lock your doors when you stop your car, and take off your seatbelt when you stop your car, because I've seen a lot of surveillance videos of murders and other violent crimes, and a lot of them happen I've seen some happen in cars, but you have to be able to maneuver. You don't want to stop and then, you know, be stuck. So, you know, maybe you should keep your car running in certain instances. And also, I've seen a lot of the murders will happen at gas stations. That was interesting. And then other places they call them transitional spaces. And so these are places where people can move into a space and out of the space relatively quickly. And a lot of times people will use that time to harm other people. So be careful about that. And the last thing I wanted to say is always check over your shoulders, over both shoulders. I've noticed that a lot of people will only look over one shoulder. And then so there's one side that's a weak side. I've even followed a relative home, you know, just to make sure that they're being careful. They didn't know I was following them. But I was able to follow them because I stayed on one side of them. One side, and they wouldn't look in that one direction. Don't do that. Be careful. Thank you.
Be alert about your surroundings. Could not agree more. And try to minimize, if you can, that walking alone, walking late night. Dr. Kanban talked about that as well. Even driving late night, really. Dr. Kanban talks about that a lot, too. But definitely walking late night and alone, not a smart idea. I used to have a non-white pal who would harp about that a lot and say, hey, make sure you're not out there walking, talking to me and talking to other victims of racism that you knew. You know, don't wait if you got to go to the grocery store or some even things that are close, because you'll have, you know, stores that are like a block away. So it's really easy. Like, hey, get that stuff done in the daytime. No need to be out walking. Some would throw it back to me. Somebody talks about white supremacy all the time. You would think black people would be in danger being outside walking on the street at midnight. Yes. Follow logic. What can I say? But yes, yes. Any other comments folks need to get in before we conclude? If you have any suggestions for managing all the chaos with the so-called holidays, you can share that as well before we wrap up.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Yes. Man, I'm trying to think of a white person that's bulletproof to go talk to the other ones. I know. They would have to be, though, you know, because whites will punish other whites for doing what they, you know, doing anything to help us, you know, that's been known. To me, there's a book called Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And it's written by, I know her last name is Zuboff. She is pretty much breaking down how we moved away from, you know, the commercial capitalism and slavery into the industrial era. And how we're at the verge of moving into a new form of capitalism based off of data mining and surveillance. And that's a huge part of what's happening now. And she calls it surveillance capitalism. Of course, United States is a capitalist country. In China, that's called social credit, you know, but it's a totally different premise because that's a socialist country. So you kind of see, you know, why companies like Facebook, who sells nothing, are worth $200-300 billion, you know, because they are selling your data, you know, your information. Also, they reached a point through their eugenics programs, and eugenics broke down into two areas. One was more psychology and philosophy. The other one was technology. And the technology broke down into two areas. One is transhumanism. The other one is human enhancement. So they're to the point where they have technology to have create a system to replace this current system of white supremacy to another one that's even more dangerous, you know. That's where I see them going with the technology. In fact, Gus, I did a show called The End of White Supremacy, Beginning of Cyborg Supremacy. And the white supremacists called in, called me nigger. You know, I mean, I back to back to back. Like, they was all over the country. It was like they planned it.
They did. They probably did, especially if you were, you know, talking about white supremacy specifically in the title. Like, yeah, they are not ignorant. They do pay attention to that sort of thing. So, hey, do more of it. Age of Surveillance, Capitalism, Racist White Supremacy, Plans for the Future. Spot probably has a page or two in there, too, I would think. Let's see. Unless you can conclude in 30 seconds. Anybody have something? 30 seconds.
I wanted to quickly say thank you for answering my question. I'll mute my line.
20 seconds. Oh, that's great.
No name calling.
Love it. No name calling. No name calling. Love it. And stand by your work. Make sure I get that in as well. We'll be here tomorrow for Rethinking Rufus. Dr. Thomas A. Foster. Sexual Violations of Enslaved Men. Looking forward to it. I emailed Dr. Curry to see if he had any questions that he thinks we should ask for the broadcast. So hopefully it'll be a constructive investment of time and energy. much obliged to everyone for participating. Man, oh man, try to be safe this week if you're doing any traveling, even if you're not traveling, if you're just, you know, picking it at your residence and spending time, I guess, with family, people that you care about. If you have, or if you have time away from the plantation, try to use it in a constructive manner. And hopefully, if you're going to be around other non-white people, it'll be constructive, no conflict. It can be a healthy time for all to kind of restore, refocus, get moving into 2020 in a more constructive manner. At least eating some good food, nothing else. If you don't get to talk about racism, like, let's make sure we're eating a little bit better moving into 2020. With that, much obliged for everyone's participation. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best, even in the so-called holiday season. They, I am sure, will have sobriety checkpoints probably starting this weekend. That would be my guess, to try to nab non-white people, say, who are under the influence, give them some tickets and other things to cause more problems for them. Sobriety. If you got to consume, get to one spot and stay there. Make sure you're in a location where you don't have to have contact with whites, don't have to talk to them, and certainly will not come into contact with any race soldiers. And make sure you're in an environment where you're not going to be in conflict with any other non-white people, because that happens often as well, which can indirectly lead you into contact with racists. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in our vehicle. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. If you are driving, you are buckled, sober, and not on the cell phone. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.